The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, good morning. My cell phone indicates to me that I should start talking out loud. So I'm going to start doing just that. My name is Chris Schlecht. I teach at New St. Andrews College. I have been involved in classical Christian education longer than my current students have been alive, which is frightening. It's also frightening to teach some of the history that spans my own lifetime sometimes that I do that. I'm the head of the Classical Christian Studies program at New St. Andrews College, which is a program that actually helps to cater to teachers who find themselves in a position of delivering a liberal arts education that they haven't received. And so certainly welcome any questions and conversations about that over at the New St. Andrews table. But the topic that I was tasked to take up with you is called Break the Subject Barrier with the Trivium, Logic and Rhetoric. And I think, yes, if I can step away, it's strange looming up high like that, interesting room configuration. But I want to begin, students, with a question. And you're going to answer this question at the end of our conversation here, and you're going to include specific reference to at least two of the images that I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you a series of images, and you're going to comment, offer your reflections on this question. It's a claim. Do you agree or disagree with this claim? The consequence of World War II for women is this. The presence of women in the workforce eroded conventional beliefs about the differences between men and women. What I have here, my first image is from the Boeing plant. That's a Rolls-Royce Merlin engine being put into a fighter plane. Rolls-Royce, that's a British company, but they were an ally. So how might this image inform comments on this question? We only have 50 minutes. Very good. Yes?
Well, obviously, you have women working on an engine, which is stereotypically done by men. So the idea that, hey, women can do this too is definitely being presented here, which is, I mean, it's leading the question a little bit, but that's the point.
Okay. Very good. We could go on about this. But another image, how about this one? This is also from the Boeing plant. How might this image inform an answer to the question that I put to you? Yes, up front. And go ahead and talk backwards here so the people who paid a lot for their seats back here can hear what you'd have to say. Oh, did you catch that?
Yes.
Okay. I would have had to repeat it. I understand the air conditioning is just brutal on us here. But if you're able to hear her, she commented on her clothing. Make some observations about her clothing. Wearing different clothing than the women in the first image. Now, we have some conversations about women in the military today. How might this image inform an answer to the question, or inform a response to the question that the wartime experience eroded the differences between men and women, conventional notions. What do you think? Yes, and you have to really bellow it so they can hear you over the air conditioning.
Depending on what you focus on in the picture, will support either one side or the other.
Okay.
Okay. Her hair is done well. She has makeup on. She
Okay. She's, look here. Look at her face. Yeah, makeup. Good. We can go on and on here. Similar image, right? I won't invite specific comment on that one. How about this one? We need women in the military, don't we? We're trying to defeat the Nazis, aren't we? And the Japanese out in the Pacific. And we need women to help out for that. And we're trying to recruit them. And we're trying to bring women in the military, which means they need to be like men. What do you think? How does this image inform our response to the question?
They don't look like men.
Yeah. Yeah, what's the appeal? It's advertising, so you're trying to play to something that's valued by your target audience. Yes.
As nurses, yes, but as fighting men,
no. Okay. Okay. Why? Go ahead.
It appears that they're trying to say you can be in the army and still be a woman.
Okay.
You can be in the military but still have.
How does this say that? Where's that in the?
You've got the makeup. You've got the dress is still from that time period.
Okay.
Feminine. And you jump forward 50 years and you're going to see a different.
Okay.
Poster, right?
Well, I haven't asked you about 50 years. Yeah, I don't see 1990s there. I see 1940s. Okay,
right.
Good. Yes.
It's saying that if there are women in there that look like that, guys are going
to be well, oh, that's interesting. What's the offer here? How about any observation about the text?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Okay, so does that mean women are becoming like men? Okay.
The role is clearly defined as well in the text as a condemner.
Here we go. We need women. This is a Q-Tex nail polish advertisement. Okay. Now, but this is what I do for fun, by the way, as I wade through Mademoiselle from the 1940s. I'm actually not kidding. Here we have all the branches of the armed services in posters behind her. We can go on about this. I love this. Elizabeth Arden came out with a new shade of lipstick, Montezuma Red, to match the chevrons on the woman's uniform that was designed by prominent fashion designers. Montezuma Red, Elizabeth, and not to be outdone, DeBerry Cosmetic Company also came out with a new hue of lipstick to match. Here's an advertisement. It could go on and on like this. This was fascinating. I saw this I think this was Hearst International Cosmopolitan, if I'm not before the current incarnation of Cosmopolitan. The text, it's hard for you to see the text there, so here's what the text on the ad says. You too, like thousands of other women, can do men's work without sacrificing one bit of feminine loveliness. Why do you need this underwear? The secret is to ensure a lovely line, be fitted to a form fit tailored to precision foundation girdle and bra. The better stores have them. The heading is doing man's work. True or false, agree or disagree, the presence of women in the workforce made women more like men. Yes. you'll see this claim in a lot of textbooks and stock presentations of life in World War II. We can go on like this, but I'll put the teacher trainer's hat back on and the teacher's hat off, change the geography of my location here in the room. But this is the beginnings of a lesson I would have you write on this, and you had to comment on two specific images. I'm here to distinguish in my mind between what I think is a mediocre teacher and a great teacher. Mediocre teachers train up their students to approach the teacher's own level, to attain what the teacher has attained, or at least to get really close to that. Great teachers teach students to go well beyond where the teacher ever was. And I've thought about this. I've thought about this for years. A lot of my own reflection on teaching comes from this paradox and trying to navigate this paradox, and I'm still working my way through it. One of the great paradoxes of education is that a teacher's own mastery of the material is a huge limitation for the student. The teacher's own mastery of the material is limited, and that presents a huge limitation for the student. At the very same teacher, if he's a good teacher, limited as he is, the teacher is the one who is supposed to equip the students to exceed that limit. The worst thing in the world for my students would be for them to turn out just like me and to go no further. That's not what I want for my children. That's not what I want for my grandchildren. And the teacher who's cast that vision is a teacher who's casting a vision for mediocrity. I want my students to be like me, pretty mediocre. No, if I'm a great teacher, I want my students to leave me in the dust. But I'm the one who's supposed to get them there, and I have limitations in my own background and exposure. How do I do that? See the paradox here. This workshop flows from my reflection upon this paradox. I teach a lot of history. A lot of the examples are going to be drawn from fairly recent history. That's why I say fairly recent World War II, because I'm standing in the wake of Herodotus and Thucydides, who are my heroes. Herodotus, who wrote about a war that's as distant in time to him as this conflict was in distance in time to us. By the way, one of the silly conceits of classical education is that you always have to talk about the Greeks and the Romans. I'd much rather do what the Greeks and the Romans did. And so this is very Herodotian of me to talk about World War II, even as Herodotus talked about the Persian Wars, or Thucydides talking, almost a journalist, talking about his own level. All right, so here we go. You can write your essay and have fun with it. Knock yourself out. What I want to show you here is in my traveling around in classical education. This was fairly routine. I travel from different schools. Sometimes I'm asked to do teacher in-service training, and this is a test, a final examination, it's probably hard for you to see it here, but it was a final examination of a history test from a classical Christian school that frankly concerned me, and I want to walk through it here. So that first section, the first page, this was an 8-page test. So there's the fill in the blank. This is a kind of a blow up of that first page here. So students are supposed to fill in. By the way, this student did great. This is 102 out of 100. So this is graded from an ACCS school. Book showed Rome's fall due to sin, city of God. Most scholarly Latin father. Apparently that was Jerome. Who influenced Augustine's conversion? Well, the right answer is Ambrose, apparently. Maybe his mother Monica. Well, the right answer was Ambrose. There's a bunch of tells in this test to me that helps me to think about what this classroom had been like for the previous semester. Okay. The tells are that students were taught to respond in a certain way to a certain stimulus. And the stimulus was when the tagline slogan, Father of Church History, is offered in class, then this is the response to that stimulus. And we can make our way all through the test. Okay, so here's a list of dates, list of people, events, that sort of thing. I don't have any problem. Oh, an extra credit if you have the year in which Leo the First confronted Attila. Let's see. I'm making my way through the test here. Five pillars of Islam. Name the four prominent bishoprics of the young Christian church. I love that definite article. The right answer and the right way of thinking about it is that the number of prominent bishoprics in the early Christian church was four. And so, do you see stimulus? Response. Got one of them. The student got some extra credit. And apparently, Carthage wasn't a prominent bishopric. Wasn't one of the four, anyway. Who were the four Latin intellectuals? There they are right here. For bonus points, tell what each man did. Boethius, on writing the words consolation of philosophy, earned a bonus point because that's what the first one listed did. Stimulus, response. What were the three divisions of Clovis's kingdom? List three characteristics. Oh, here we go. Three characteristics of the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire had characteristics which can be reduced to a list, and that list is three in number. Stimulus, response. Now we can go to essay questions. Essay question. What were the reasons for the fall of Rome? You probably can't read this well. I'll read the student's answer. What were the reasons for the fall of Rome? This is an essay where the students are supposed to reason, right? And it's really this question, as you're going to find out, this was a perfect 20 out of 20 answer in the teacher's judgment. In 476, Rome fell by the hand of Odoacer. It fell for many reasons. The biggest reason was the fact that Rome was unable to attain a workable political system, which eventually weakened the economy. The Romans also failed to innovate due to slavery. The Christian beliefs undermined the Roman values, causing an increase in Christianity. As more people flooded to Rome, the traditional Roman traditions slowly vanished and the non-Italian culture and traditions appeared. The people of Rome were also weakened by lead poisoning from cutlery in everyday use. The plague also wiped out much of the population. Rome fell for many reasons. Some reasons came from its wanton need to grow, and others came from the little scientific knowledge that they had. Whatever the reason, we know that God wanted Rome to fall. It was a list. In different form, an essay, which it was really no different than some of the previous questions. Stimulus, response. Stimulus, response. I actually have concerns about that class, as I have expressed to the administrator at the school. There's a number of tells, and that's a final exam. There's a number of tells that indicate to me probably how that class worked. Okay, and I hope that you're seeing what I'm seeing. Okay, we can go on. I think I've made my point. What are we after? I've got some other examples that are happier that I want to offer to you. But I would encourage you to be on the lookout for these sorts of things. What are the tells? What are the things, you know, the ladies talk about? We're talking about ladies' garments. You know, your slip is showing. Assess your own assessments, and what do they say about the teacher and the teaching, and actually what students are going through, in their class. I remember my first year of teaching full time. I had a very good administrator, And the administrator was going to do an observation, and so I was going to do my utmost best because he was going to be sitting in the classroom that day. And so I worked extra hard on that lesson. And I remember I wound up filling the board with notes, but oh, it wasn't the way I typically fill a board today. It was really well organized on the board, easy to follow, point by point by point. I still vividly remember that lesson. It was over 20 years ago. On the late Middle Ages and late medieval papacy, I remember talking about the Great Western Schism and Pope Boniface VIII, and so I'm just tempted to reinvent that lesson for you now and to reenact it. And there were some really interesting insights and connections that I was careful to bring out. And I remember by the end of the day, it was in the morning during that class period when the teacher came in to, or when the administrator came in, at the end of the day, there in my box was the written assessment to, as the preface to the meeting that I was going to have with my administrator. And the word at the top of the page was unsatisfactory. It's why my kids are at that school today, because the administrator cared enough to give what I was doing an unsatisfactory mark. And the administrator explained to me that he spent the entire time watching the students. I thought teaching was about me. I thought teaching was about me. It's not. Teaching is about the students. Learning is something that students do. Learning is something that students do. And if students aren't doing that, then you're not teaching. What's interesting about the whole teaching enterprise then is that a good teacher actually is someone who is getting the students to do. A good teacher, some of the best classroom observations I have done have been where, with a hum of activity and the teacher sitting at the desk. Some of the worst classroom observations I have done have been when the teacher's up front. Because, and I learned from my administrator, which was a Copernican revolution in my own understanding, thinking that I was the sun about which the planets of education revolved because I'm a teacher, right? No, I am, well, the students need to be that sun. They are the center. And everything is about what they're doing. Now, as a teacher, I am responsible for what they are doing. Right? But learning is something that students have to do. Get yourself out of the way. That lesson that I described on the late medieval papacy was a great display of somebody's learning in the room. Mine and not theirs. Students need to be learners, and a teacher makes that happen. Coaches, induces, goads, and makes that happen. That test was a reflection of, and the lesson that I just described to you that I gave, with a wise administrator that knew how to do a good classroom observation, was a display of thinking that teachers are the most important thing in the classroom. Students are the most important. I mean, why is a teacher there? It's for the students. And you're trying to, and sometimes students are reluctant. Sometimes students are unwilling. Sometimes students are resistant. Sometimes students are tired. A teacher will get them to learn. That's what teachers do. Teachers don't just manifest their own learning. This brings me to, one further illustration before I move on to this slide here. I have a 19-month-old granddaughter now. I love my granddaughter. We're used to playing with her, and when she plays, she doesn't cast a very big wake. She's only 19. She's not even 2 yet. And I've built blocks with her. When it's time to pick up the blocks, imagine changing, time for dinner, whatever, and I see my son working with my granddaughter. The blocks could be picked up in 10 seconds if the parent does it. To get her to do it, it takes 3-4 minutes project to put the blocks away. 10 seconds versus 4 minutes. I've seen so many teachers not understand the difference between cleaning up blocks and making a person. You don't make the floor clean. You make this little girl into the person that she ought to be. That takes 4 minutes. I have to get through the material. And so, good, you talked about the material. You hit the talking points on your curriculum guide. Good, fat lot of good that does. And they're good, disciplined, conscientious students, well-mannered. And so they studied for this test like what this student did. And then the student vomited out. And the teacher thinks that the teacher succeeded because look at how good the students did on the test. Most of my students are college students now, New St. Andrews College. We go through the Peloponnesian War, and we go through Thucydides, usually when they're sophomores. Now, on the dais as they graduate, I picture myself sometimes doing this. They've received their diploma, and I'm going back up there to greet them, and they've graduated. If I were to ask them, what were the years of the Peloponnesian War? And I don't think that there's one New St. Andrew, well, actually, there's probably a few, but most of them will not be able to answer that question correctly, which meant I failed as a teacher. Is that the takeaway that I should get as a teacher, that I failed them because at the time they graduate, a couple years after they've been in the class, they can't perform. Actually, when they were in my class, I knew that they could do that. I did put them through some of the paces and facts and that sort of thing. But if that were the measure, then I will have failed. Now, if they are completely lost, if a New St. Andrews College graduate had no idea where to place that question, how to find out the answer to that question, then I would have something to worry about. But I'm actually not at all worried that most of my graduates cannot answer the question on the dates of the Peloponnesian War. I am not worried one whit about that. There are other things that would worry me. So do those other things come up? What are those other things? Do those other things come up in class? Are they in your reflection as you teach? And this is where I want to distinguish information from habit formation, from character formation. Information from habit formation, from character formation. Information is what you think it is, and I have nothing more insightful to tell you about what information is. Habit formation, these are repeated behaviors to the point where they become instinct. You get into a car, and what do? You probably haven't even really thought about it, but these are habits, right? When a great major league shortstop fields a grounder and goes to first base, that's probably thousands of grounders fielded. Each one is unique, that bounding ball traversing its course through the infield, across the green and into the dark, rusty dirt of the infield. And he collects it, and that's a unique experience, right? No two grounders are quite alike. You should follow more baseball. It's beautiful. And yet he goes from second to first, turns that double play. It's a habit. It's a habit. Habit formation. When an intellectual challenge comes, like that grounder, what does the student do? How does the student respond? What are the habits that are being cultivated here? We went through that exercise. What they say about women in World War II is far less interesting to me than the habit of going to the source, going to the source, going to the source. Are they linking their assertion with what the source says? And if they forget some of the details of World War II, but their habit is, what's the source say? And I can interrogate a source. That's gold, and that's what I want my graduates to come away with, a habit, right? I can see the habits that were being formed in that final exam that I described. Stimulus response. Think about the habit behind it, not just the information, but there's a habit, there's a performance, a way. What did the student go through to get a great grade on that test? Well, whatever it is they're going through, formed habits, stimulus response, pack in info, not reasoning from sources, not some of the other things that we might talk about. So I've got some reflections on habit formation. This is at the college level. At New St. Andrews College, the faculty came together and sort of formed a rubric for habits that we'd like to see in our students, and then some character attributes that we'd like to see in our students. Because they're habits, I think that these are good habits to think about in high schools, junior high schools, all right? Rhetoric, the ability to communicate with clarity, precision, and aesthetic persuasiveness. As a habit, an ability to communicate with clarity, precision, and aesthetic persuasiveness. Dialectic, an ability to draw distinctions and connections. I want the students to habitually draw distinctions, connections, to analyze and to synthesize, to induce and deduce. Certain ways of responding when that grounder comes. I want it to be automatic, second nature, that they parse, that they combine, and they know how to do that in a way that's fitting to the material that becomes before them, just like the grounder that might come before the shortstop. Perspective, a humble understanding of oneself and of one's opponents, an understanding of the limitations of one's own understanding, without that humility leading to relativism. A humble understanding of oneself and of one's opponents, of the limitations of one's own understanding, without that humility leading to relativism. Observation, I want them to observe, to pay close attention at various levels of detail, 20,000 feet overview and the leaf of the forest, over the forest and the map, and then the leaf on the tree in the forest, various levels of detail. Process, the ability to see a problem and then to develop an intelligent process for going to find out what the solution might be. Notice that this is subject, all of this is subject independent. Am I talking about literature? Yes. Am I talking about history? Yes. Am I talking about calculus? Yes. When you're talking about habits, you're breaking the barrier of subjects here, right? And it needs to be in the foreground of your administrators, of your curriculum guides. How many of you have curriculum guides that are filled with, you need to spend 3 weeks on Rome covering this, 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 and this, and when a teacher who's a stinky teacher who doesn't get kids comes to you and can justify what they're doing in the classroom because they are ticking the boxes on your own curriculum guide, which is the basis for you to assess them, then maybe we need to revisit the way your curriculum guide's written. I've actually had that experience, helping out, coming alongside. This was at Logos School, where my kids, and this was some years ago, but they bring me in sometimes to help out with some of the teachers, and this was a teacher that was struggling, and the teacher came to me and presented the curriculum guide to me, and I see why your habits are what they are. This is, anyway. But the problem was the teacher wasn't thinking in these terms and understanding life in these terms, habit formation. So anyway, that's process. Imagination is the last one. A creative eye, which is eager to look for new ways of telling the story, of solving a problem. An intellectual curiosity and a habit of copiousness, which is looking at the whole expanse of the world and bringing it to bear on the question at hand. That's imagination. So these are intellectual habits: rhetoric, dialectic, perceptive, perspective, observation, process, imagination, which forms a certain kind of character. On the same document, we've got habits, and habits mature into the kind of person we want to graduate. What do you want your graduates to look like? People who know the four Latin intellectuals? Like the graduate I just imagined who may or may not know the dates of the Peloponnesian War. Whether or not they know the dates of the Peloponnesian War at the time they graduate tells me nothing about what their experience with me had in their lives, right? It tells me nothing. Character formation. Courage. Not brash foolishness, but a conviction that what must be done or said will be done or said, regardless of the opposition it will create, unflustered and undistracted by personal panic or others venting their emotions. I want my students to be courageous. It's a virtue. Toughness. An intolerance directed towards self for convenient excuses, resulting in perseverance and dependability. A disposition to see trials and challenges as opportunities and a readiness to assume responsibility. An intolerance directed toward themselves about making excuses. That's toughness. Initiative. A free man's ability to drive himself to complete tasks without a master standing over. The ability to push himself into new ventures without hand-holding, resulting in a desire to be more than an appreciator, but a doer and a creator. Someone who gets off their keister without being told. Initiative. Intellectual integrity. An intolerance for inconsistencies and a patience for mysteries. An intolerance for inconsistencies, inconsistency in life and in belief, inconsistency in whatever ways it might present itself, and a patience for mystery. Zeal. Don't you want your students to be zealous? A godly hunger for the advance of God's kingdom. Evangelical loyalty. A deep and abiding loyalty to and confidence in the gospel and the faithful church. A love for God and for neighbor. A hunger for holiness and the fruits of the Spirit. So these are, don't you want to graduate these kinds of characters? How do you think about that in the classroom? How do you think about that in the classroom? If you can inculcate these attributes, these habits, and these character formation, then your students can run way out beyond you in life. And that's what we want. That helps us through this paradox that I talked about earlier. All right. Never mind the hitting here. I want to give you another test. Here's another kind of test. This is a test in United States history, again. And the students who were given this test have not seen the documents. The first time they have seen the documents is when they show up in the test. Essay, examine the following three historical sources and then prepare a well-crafted essay that captures something true and meaningful about the time period represented by these sources. In the essay, here's laying out the requirements. Assert a clear thesis statement and deploy all three sources in support of your thesis statement. Come up with one thesis statement, and it's got to be meaningful, non-trivial. It's got to be meaningful, and it's got to talk about all three sources. Political cartoon from 1869. This is a man wielding a cat of nine tails and a somebody obviously Chinese. Caption at the bottom, encouragement to Chinese immigration. The text on the building in the background, courts of justice closed to Chinese, extra taxes to the yellow jack. That's from Harper's Weekly, 1869. That's one source. Students haven't seen it, but they're being tested on something that they haven't seen. Painting by John Gast, American Progress. You've got Columbia, Lady Columbia, famous painting. Many of you have seen it. Of course, you've got everyone's moving from right to left, and you've got the factories and the shipping and the bridges, and oh, here comes the railway. She's got what? Telegraph wire, yes. And, of course, receding into the lower left are the Native Americans and so forth. American Progress. Very good. And document number three is, and I'll just summarize this, I provided the text for what that is. That's a page out of the minutes of the First Presbyterian Church in Oregon Territory, and just a page talking about the baptism of some Native Americans and the welcoming in, actually it was Chief Joseph's father who was baptized, and the welcoming into membership of a fur trapper, and then the next entry is the excommunication of the fur trapper for swapping wives. But anyway, so There's your test. I've never seen this before. I haven't seen these sources before. Show me what you can do. Any high school student who is playing basketball has not quite seen the game situation, whatever game situation, that this combination of opponents. We're very comfortable with that in the basketball game. And their character and their habits come out if you're a good basketball coach, right? So, what are their habits? What are they going to... Oh, here's a problem. I need to figure out, can I parse? Can I notice and observe? Can I... And that's going to be a pretty good measure of what you've been doing and inculcating in the classroom. This actually is a final exam in my class. It's a final exam. I'll also tell you, I gave... I won't go back to it, but that underwear ad... This is just all very true. The underwear ad was the basis for a final exam essay, and students hadn't seen it. And I put a question to it that was similar to the question that I put to you. And said, oh, they have to confront this underwear ad. Never seen it before. Hadn't talked about that underwear ad. But I want to test them. That's a test. See the difference? So I'll give you some sample lesson plans that I think are a little bit more successful, and that's how I'm going to spend the rest of my time, some sample lesson plans and some samples of student work for you to think about. So let's talk about A Tale of Three Cities, class. And when we're done tomorrow, you're going to be divided up into small groups, and you're going to do a skit. And it's going to be about a... And this is all about A Tale of Three cities. What city is this one? St. Louis. What is this? Why do you know it's St. Louis? Okay, what does anyone know?
Gateway to the West.
Oh, excellent. Very good. City number two. Anyone know this one? Maybe less telltale. Oh, very good. So we've got some Midwesterners here. What body of water is that, by the way? Oh, we got some good geographers here. This one might be, if you're one of my students, you wouldn't, very rare that my students would get this one right. Some of you might. This is Buffalo, and one of the most prominent features on the landscape in Buffalo, New York. Now, this resonates with people from the Inland Northwest where I teach, because everyone will recognize what that is. They just won't recognize the city. Well, what is it? Yeah, it's a grain silo. Anyone who's in Idaho where I'm teaching will immediately recognize what it is. They just might not tag the city. Buffalo is the city of grain elevators. More and larger grain elevators in Buffalo, New York than anywhere else in the world. Which my students didn't know. Maybe some of you didn't know that either. All right, but that's city number three. St. Louis, Chicago, and Buffalo. All right, here's another slide. Why is St. Louis the gateway to the West? Or why is that the moniker that they attach to themselves? Okay, set real loud so they can hear you. Good, go ahead.
The confluence of the Missouri and Mississippi rivers.
Good. This map indicates... During the fur trade, which really brought people out west, far more than Lewis and Clark, by the way, which are overrated in the history books, but I can go on to that later. The fur trappers were a much, much bigger deal. The Oregon Trail followed fur trade routes I can go on and on. But St. Louis was the dispatch point. And why St. Louis? How is it that you're going to get the skin from the beaver and his fur onto a hat in London? And how does St. Louis figure into that? Or Paris? All roads, you see it on the map, all roads lead to St. Louis. Why? Why are they going to St. Louis?
River.
What river?
Mississippi.
Mississippi. And then Mississippi to where?
The Gulf.
And from the Gulf to where? Yeah, okay, there we go. That's how you get your Pacific Northwest beaver pelt into a hat in London. Excellent. All right. So this is what the landscape pretty much looked like in, say, 1840. Let's fast forward one generation. Here's another map. One generation away, 20 years. Or about 30 years, about 1870. Does a city stand out?
Chicago.
What happened to St. Louis? Oh, my goodness, what happened to St. Louis? Here is your challenge. Now, the question is, how are you going? Is it going to be beaver pelts? Probably not beaver pelts. It's going to be a host of other things, like grain. We'll talk about sacks of grain in a little while. But here's your assignment, two groups. Group number one, you are going to take a sack of grain through St. Louis to market. And the characters in the skit are listed as follows. A Midwest wheat farmer, a railroad hauler. I'm sorry, not a railroad. I scratched that. This is a typo. The railroad hauler is not supposed to be there. But a Mississippi riverboat, a shipper, ocean-going shipper, a New York wholesaler, and a New York baker. Take the grain to the bakery in New York, and you need to give a skit representing the interests of each individual, right? Group number two, pretty much the same thing, but now it's Chicago. Represent the interest in the transaction of the following individuals, and you got the Midwest wheat farmer, the Iowa wheat farmer, to the baker. All right. So you're going to tell the story of how the grain gets from the same farm from Iowa to New York, but one is going to tell the story of Chicago, and another one's going to tell the story of St. Louis. That's your task. I would probably leave it at about that with the students. Okay? And then I would give them I have a packet of a few readings, and one of the readings is going to be about buffalo, okay, which I've already teased him about. But let's think about a little geography here. So I've given you your task, and everyone knows what their task is. Now I'm going to give you a little bit further explanation. How do you get, say, grain from Chicago to New York? What's the route? Well, this. So here's, we want to go from here on Lake Michigan to here. How are you going to get it there? Yeah, well, we've got an interesting issue that develops in the 1840s here. Oh, that's an interesting city that develops. Okay, we've got the Erie Canal, Lake Michigan through the Great Lakes, and from the Great Lakes to Buffalo, where your shipping needs to be offloaded, then the Hudson River and on down, right? So you're with me on that. There's your geography lesson. All right. Does geography matter in history? So here we go. We can go through. There's Chicago and St. Louis. Now, once you harness steam, this is going to become clear in the reading that I gave you. Once you harness steam, you can do a host of things with it. In fact, you can attach it to a conveyor, a machine. It's what a grain silo does, is it takes your grain, moves it up a hill, right, and dumps it into the grain silo. Big machinery there. All those grain silos in Buffalo. Well, Lake Michigan, from 1918 down on into the present, the water levels of Lake Michigan, I got this from the National Organization, NOAA. And it moves from about 175 to 176, sometimes topping out 177 meters above sea level. Okay? And so you see this here from, this is 175 meters to 177 meters from 1917 to present. So the water levels in Lake Michigan fluctuate about my height over a century. Right? Now, this morning I got onto Noah's website, Mississippi River at St. Louis, in feet this week. This week, and this is how it's been historically. Actually, so this morning it was at 19 feet. By this time next week, it's going to be down to about 11, Mississippi River. You want to put a machine at the wharf on the Mississippi? What's the problem with that? When you're hauling sacks of grain, it's really not a problem because your foot traffic can make up the difference. But if you need to fix a big machine there, it's kind of hard when you're dealing with the water levels being what they are. Historically, let's look at the water levels of the Mississippi. Low from minus 6 below sea level up to pushing 50 feet above sea level. Is that a little different than Lake Michigan? So why do we have those grain elevators in Buffalo? And why do all the rail lines go through Chicago and not St. Louis when rail comes online? Because of the water levels of the Mississippi and Lake Michigan. Anyway, we can go on and on about this. I've got some readings that help to cover that. But and then, students, you're going to have a skit that represents, and you're going to piece this together with the interest of every transaction along the way. Okay, come back tomorrow, and you're going to present your skit to us. All right. That's just a sample lesson. I told you I'm just going to work through some samples here. Let's look at some student work. Now, this is a mature student. And I gave students a museum project where the students need to find some sources from the time period, mass circulating magazines from the time period we're talking about, and they need to represent something meaningful about it. They give me a proposal and some sources, then I review the proposal and sources, give them some tips. So this student's, so imagine this as a photograph of a display board, Satchmo and the Cold War. So here's the interpretive text. We never covered Louis Armstrong in my class. How the Cold War aided the civil rights movement in the United States. As the United States and the Soviet Union competed for the friendship of foreign nations during the Cold War, each sought any and every opportunity to tarnish the reputation of the other. The discrimination against African Americans in the United States gave the Soviets perfect ammunition. U.S. officials realized that in order to remain a champion for freedom in the eyes of the watching world, it was crucial for America to rid itself of its racist reputation. One way the U.S. retaliated was by creating the Jazz Ambassadors Program, made up of prominent and importantly African-American musicians, including the king of jazz himself, Louis Satchmo Armstrong. As a jam ambassador, Armstrong was to, this is the student's text here on this display board. As a jam ambassador, Armstrong was to travel the world, play his music, and fan a flame of goodwill toward the United States, and fan the flame he did. Wherever he went, cats, jazz fans, flocked by the thousands, some even slipping under the Iron Curtain just to hear him play. Needless to say, it was unique for an African-American man to have that kind of extraordinary influence in the 1950s. While Armstrong was happy to do his part for Uncle Sam abroad, at home he remained frustrated with racial inequality. After President Eisenhower refused to send federal troops to Little Rock, Arkansas to enforce school integration laws, Armstrong canceled his tour to Russia, upsetting American officials and forcing them to realize the leverage he wielded. It worked. 2 weeks later, Eisenhower sent the National Guard to Little Rock, and an approving Armstrong agreed to a tour of South America. While most will remember Armstrong's foreign tours for his music, they were politically significant as well, embodying the ironic truth of how the Cold War actually aided the civil rights movement within the United States, a point that I didn't teach her. And so she's got articles from the period, Ambassador with a Horn, various newspaper articles. This one, the caption says, in this 1955 article, the writer clearly noticed what an asset the influential Armstrong was to the United States when it came to foreign policy, jazz and the Cold War, and the international posturing. and so forth. And then Satchmo tells off Ike. Great headline. Now I've given them some of the tools to find these resources. But I thought that this was pretty creative. How do you get a student to do this? Well, you need to, first of all, model it yourself. You need to model it yourself. You need to have some stuff that's interesting, and you need to be the kind of person who habitually does that. I already alluded to baseball. You know, for an example like this, what is this?
Stats.
Yeah, what do we, we call this collection of stats in this form what? Yeah, started appearing around the same time that the railroads appeared. Baseball is played where? In rural or urban settings in its big-time incarnation? Yeah, very much. Have you ever been to a big league ballpark? And you go in and you walk in, maybe the first time that you were there and you walked in, you might notice the expanse of the stands, and then you look out, and what color do you see down before you? Oh, green, and maybe that mown grass. Can you smell it? Oh, it's glorious, glorious. How long does it take to play a baseball game? How is it determined how long it takes to play a baseball game?
Innings.
Yeah. How is it determined how long to play a basketball game? Oh, baseball has its own natural rhythms. Baseball is agrarian in its values. Why do you suppose that that would be so fetching to city people in the 1870s? You can imagine this, right? Now, one of the things that we see in cities, and I can ask you all kinds of questions, prompt you to talk about why people were gathering in cities in the late 19th century. They were gathering. Why? Because of manufacturing. So, and you know the answer to the question. We can have the discussion. Pull this all out of the students. I don't have to, with some prompting questions. And you've got these big corporations, right? Big corporations that have multi-layers of management for the first time in history. Middle managers. What are they doing? They're sitting at desks, managing inventories all day long, something that, you know, craftsmen used to do for an hour a day now becomes the specialization of the middle managers, who are wusses because they're not doing any heavy lifting because they still have agrarian values. So they're going to be attracted to baseball but reduce its movements to statistics. A box score is 19th century industrialism. All thematic roads lead to it. Anyway, and that's just, I mean, I love this stuff. And I would go through that with the students. Okay, now you do it. Oh, my parents had Louis Armstrong albums. I wonder how that might matter. That's what that student did. I didn't talk about Louis Armstrong. Here's another one, another museum display. Maurice Sendak, this student remembers where the wild things are and decided to look up Maurice Sendak in reviews when this book came out. Very good. 1960s youth culture down here. Sendak's themes of children's independence and self-expression, including sexual expression, as well as his frightening dream states and monsters, stand in stark contrast to the little Ford Fauntleroys of previous generations. Sendak's books and the adult reactions to them reflect aspects of conflict in 1960s youth culture. And she found these fascinating. Well, there's a riff on her board on the left about youth culture and anxieties about where young people are going, and then reviews of where the wild things are. The overwhelming response to Sendak was delight, but the worries people had about the new youth movement applied to him as well. Many thought his books inappropriately led to fed the imaginations of young children. And so here's one review that thinks, oh, it's really good because it's feeding the imagination of children. Here's another review that says, this is a little dangerous what you feed the imagination of children and youth today, a review from 1969. I could have talked about, this is cooler than Woodstock, isn't it? A student came up, I would have never thought of this. I love this. I never talked about Nerys Sendak in my class. Another great review, the Ladies' Home Journal. This student, Peanuts. Peanuts, this is from the 1950s. All this talking about Charlie Brown, the loser, and the popularity of Peanuts at a time when we have Sputnik and Yuri Gagarin, and the Russians are totally beating our pants off in the space race at that time. And we've got the loser for whom everything turns out okay. It's a great interpretation. I love that handling of Peanuts. Those are just some examples of student work that I'm pretty pleased with that students can do. And it's pretty cool. I didn't teach them that, or did I? Did I or didn't I? I didn't think of connecting Peanuts to that theme. All right. But I try to role model those connections as students interact with me, and I talk about some themes, give them some readings with some themes. But can they interrogate a source when a student is paging through an old magazine? Have I trained them to react to that grounder bounding to them? What habits do they have when they're confronted with a problem where Schlecht is telling them that they need to find some sources and connect it to a theme? That's a problem, like that grounder and the person going to first. What habits have I given them and instilled in them? So I frankly think this is better than that examination that I started with. All right, questions, yes.
Are you familiar with the National History Day?
National History Day, big fan of National History Day. We don't participate in it, okay. But I know what it is.
But it provides a plethora of resources that take students down this.
Yeah.
And then gives them an opportunity to display it and do it, and it's display boards.
Right.
You know, it's websites, it's skits.
Right.
It does, it teaches them a lot of
things. Yeah, he's talking about National History Day, a great resource. Another... just a couple here and back. We've got time for just a couple. Far back, David?
Can we have a copy of your
slideshow? Email me, and I can reply with it. Yes? The museum project, there's actually a page of parameters, certain number of sources that they need to find. I've got limitations on the open web, so I talk about... Uncurated sources are what I call them, because there are digitized, non-curated sources. But any because you can go onto history sites that actually pre-collect some of these things for you. But anyway, it's actually a page of requirements that specifies that. Yeah, I let. I delimited the time period on this one because it was covering the time period that we went through. But I've done something similar. I remember with ninth graders, I had them, I didn't give them a lot of readings on ancient Athens. What I did is I gave them a problem. Athenian Times, I want a newspaper, and I want the newspaper to cover private life, a couple of battles from the Persian Wars, and a couple of other details, you know, political life, and... Your newspaper must include a political cartoon, an advice column, two news articles, and letters to the editor, and want ads. I want those elements reflected, and I want these parts of Athenian history reflected before I gave them resources on Athenian history. Now, when I was a kid, I played a lot of soccer. I hated to run, but I would run for 5 miles while chasing a ball around a field. Because I wasn't running, I was chasing a ball around the field, right? If I want my kids to read about ancient Athens, then I tell them to make a newspaper, and then they will read about ancient Athens. It's a big difference. They're making a newspaper. All right, very good. Well, our time is up. Thank you very much. You're a good group.
Like that museum or the
Yeah, that's this. I'm thinking much more of the secondary grades in this session.
You had to go over that curriculum line.
Right.
You're getting the kids to use
but it's
original
interesting.
Sources.
Yeah.
Your claims are your sources too basic.
Yeah.
So they're studying the water levels. But someone else could say, no, it's the politics, and the Southerners weren't trying to use government to promote the railroads. So do they need to study some historians who study?
Oh, yeah, and you can help them out with that, too. They're going to, but, so you're talking about them shaping them, that sort of thing. But I want the student, I try to imagine there will be a time when I am, the student doesn't have me. So... Yes, all we can comment on that. One of the great sins of history is monocausation that I try to instill in the students, but there's never.
But would I be unwise to hope that at least the high school student would not just be looking at data, but that he would also read a couple of historians who have expressed a conclusion about this?
Sure. Oh, sure.
And then either argue with their conclusions or defend their conclusions.
Right. On what basis?
On the basis of what other historians say, or on the basis of even
yes. So there's so I'm reinforcing to them, it's grounded in the sources, They're always going to be pulling from other people who have analyzed the sources, but they need to be thinking, they need both, but they need to know which is primary in how you, and they will start assessing historians they encounter by these.
Well, good morning, everyone. If I hop down here, everybody can still see me all right. You can see most of the eyeballs here, I think. Well, good morning, and thank you for attending my session. I appreciate the opportunity and the gracious invitation to come and speak to the ACCS this year. My name is Dr. Marcus Ross. I'm a professor of geology at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. And I'm also now the director of the Center for Creation Studies. And the Center for Creation Studies was established at Liberty University in 1985. And we have taught a course on creation evolution issues called History of Life or Creation Studies 290 to every residential student that has walked through our doors for the past 30 years. It has been a university requirement for students, regardless of major, to take Creation Studies 290. And I've been one of the primary instructors for that, and this year was asked to be the director, the leader of the Center for Creation Studies. I'm looking forward to that opportunity so that we can do hopefully more of events like this where we present leading cutting-edge creation research to educators, for both Christian, for homeschool, for other private schools, and also to advance that research, to work on more studies, to work on more lab material type of activities, or for someone like me, a geologist and a paleontologist, we go out, hit some rocks, get some fossils, and help us understand a little bit more about the world that God has made and the world that God has judged. So I like to walk around a little bit as I talk, so as I do, I'm trying, I just find it's a little bit easier to kind of do that sort of thing. I'm not one to stand behind a lectern. So today's talk is entitled Noah's Flood, Where Scripture Meets Geology. Because it is in the flood that we will find the answers, I hope, to a lot of the vexing questions that we have about origins and geology in particular. So my area of expertise is in paleontology. I always, as a little kid, loved studying fossils, loved dinosaurs. I heard about them when I was 4 years old, got the library books like crazy, read everything that I could. And by the time I was at least nine, I started realizing that there was this disconnect and this dissonance between the story that I was reading in the dinosaur books about how old they were, when they went extinct, and those sorts of things, and the faith that I had and that I was being brought up in a conservative, fundamental Baptist church at the time. And I remember being in my playroom at age nine and trying to work my way through this. And I think back to that and think, boy, I was a weird kid, which is true. Okay, there's nothing, that's an absolutely true statement. I was a weird kid. But at the same time, it reminds me that children have to deal with these deep and difficult questions at a very early age. And they are processing and thinking about them. We know that our kids can be as bright as we can help them be. And these kids are going to be asking questions that are difficult theological questions, difficult scientific questions, sometimes at a very early age. And so I resolved at that time to believe that the Bible's account of creation in 6 days was trying to tell me that it was an actual 6 days, a young earth perspective with genealogies that bring us back to only a few thousands of years ago, and that the dinosaur books must have been wrong. And by the time I went to college, my goal was to become a creation paleontologist, as are quite a number of other students that I've met at places like Cedarville University, which has an active geology program. So I get a chance to see some of their students from time to time. So in today's talk, what I want to do is help us see some of the issues that we have and see that we've got choices that have to be made and that those choices will lead to different sorts of consequences, but also certain types of opportunities for us in geology. So I'm a Christian. I'm a young earth creationist, which is unusual in the profession of paleontology. If I went to a geology meeting, we have the Geological Society of America, 5,000 or 6,000 geologists and students will be at a meeting like that. Last time I was there, there were about 30 of us who were young earth creationists, and that was up from 10 the first time I went as a grad student. So we're growing, but we're still pretty low in terms of overall numbers. The field of geology is dominated, and not just dominated, it is completely permeated by the concept of an ancient earth, and with that also biological evolution. So by profession, I'm a paleontologist and professor. I like teaching. I love the opportunity to present and convey knowledge from person to another. So this talk is going to be a bit of a version of chapter 4 in a new textbook called The Heavens and the Earth. This is a textbook that I co-authored with John Whitmore and Steve Golmer are at Cedarville University. John Whitmore is the geologist there. Steve Golmer is physics and meteorology. So he did a couple of chapters on meteorology for us. And Danny Faulkner is a name that some of you may know. He's the astronomer who works at Answers in Genesis. And prior to that, Danny Faulkner was a college professor in the University of South Carolina system for 26 years. So all four of us are accustomed to teaching, and all four of us are accustomed to teaching non-science major students. So our goal is to be able to take egghead and turn it into human for everybody that's in our classes. We're used to dealing with students who are scared to death of science and, you know, hated science in high school, but they have to take one in college. So I chose these other scholars and friends of mine to help with that because they're very good at what they do. Also, some of what I'll be presenting, but not very much, but a little bit, has just been published in the new Dictionary of Christianity and Science, which was published by Zondervan. The book surveys very broadly from Christianity for a number of different perspectives on especially hot topics, and most of the hot topics and multi-views within this book are on creation evolution issues. About 12 out of the 15 multi-viewpoint points in there are about creation evolution issues. As a caveat, though, I have to say that the overall text is not friendly to a young earth perspective at all. And there are numerous other instances in the text where young earth creationism is derided by other evangelical authors, which makes it a little bit of a sour pill to swallow, even though, you know, I'm in there and I'm very proud of the work that I and some of the others done. Also, John Mark Reynolds, who's speaking here as well, he's got a wonderful essay on young earth creationism, I should say, in that text as well. He was asked to present the overview of young earth creationism. Okay, so on to the meat of the talk here. Right, our views about origins, and in particular here, our views about Noah and the flood, are colored by our experiences with them, right? And it leads us to have mental images about what we think of immediately when I say something like Noah's Ark. If I say Noah's Ark looked like this, the sad fact is that something like this is often one of the early things that pops into our minds because this is what we grew up with as kids' toys. I have four kids, right? If you want animal-themed stuff, Noah's Ark stuff is it's an option. And it's always cute. It's adorable. It's Africa meets Snoopy's house on a canoe, right? This is the view that we have. At least with this, right, we've got a variety of animals. We've got our elephants, and we've got our hippos and giraffes. So, you know, Africa is very well represented here. We've got kangaroos, so an Australian contingent was able to make it. And apparently Noah and his wife are Amish, right, along the way. And unlike most ark boats, at least all the animals actually do fit inside this one. It's just that you have to lay them down sideways to stack them properly. And so, you know, in the end, it's not a very comfortable ride. And we all know how long the flood lasted, right? 40 days and 40 nights. And this is another place where Sunday school has failed us, because 40 days and 40 nights is not the duration of Noah's flood. It's a component of that. But we get bored. We see 40 days and 40 nights, and then it's in the 7th month or the 2nd. I don't know. It's, right? We're Americans. We're, just get to the point, right? But we have to remember that the text as we're given it is certainly a written text, but it was frequently a text that was intended to be listened to. It was intended to be heard because most of the Israelites were not literate. That's why we have the word scribes, right? Those people could actually read and write. So things like repetition, while we as moderns find it somewhat cumbersome and boring, is actually very, very important because it's how we teach our children, right? It's how we remember things. And we'll get to a little bit of that repetition here in a little bit. So a couple of important flood facts, things to think about as we dwell upon and consider the text that God has given us. One is that the Hebrew word that is translated as flood, when God says, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth, is not the typical Hebrew word for flood. In fact, the word that we translate as flood in Genesis chapter 6 through 9 is a unique word only for this particular event. That word is mabul. I have it as a license plate. I'm that kind of guy. License plates in Virginia are cheap, so my other one is dinosaur. But anyway, everybody understands dinosaur. It's driving around town, they see Mabul, and they're like, I have no idea what that, yeah, don't worry about it. It's Hebrew, it's weird. So the Hebrew word is Mabul. In fact, in every single instance of the Old Testament, which is all in Genesis, as well as two instances in the Psalms, there is an article in front of it, the article Ha, which in Hebrew is the. So it's not just Mabul, it's the Mabul. This is a titled event that is unique to this one and only instance and is used nowhere else in Scripture. When the Jews translated this into Greek for the Septuagint, they did not choose the standard Greek word for flood. Instead, they used the Greek word kataklysmos, which indicates something that is cataclysm, a big catastrophe of some kind. It involves water, which is why we translate it as flood, but it is only involving water. It is something bigger than that. In fact, when God tells Noah what he's about to do, he says, I am going to destroy the world with the earth, which as a geologist is a very, very intriguing statement, that God is going to use the earth as its own destructive means. Interesting. So when we take a look at the idea of how large the flood was, from times prior to Christianity in Judaism, and all the way through Christianity up through about the late 1700s, the unified view within the church was that Noah's flood was a global event that covered the entire world. It was not just a universal event for humanity, or humanity was restricted in some place, but rather it was an event that covered the entire face of the world. And it was viewed that way for thousands of years for very good reasons, and that's because the text of the Bible seems to indicate very, very strongly through the use of repetition that this is what God intends. So in his initial statements to Noah, I'm going to bring a flood waters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens. Every creature that has the breath of life in it, everything on earth will perish. So we see that repetition of universal terms, all, every, everything, etc. When we finally get into what I tell my students, besides the gospel accounts where we have killed our Lord, the worst chapter in the entire Bible is Genesis chapter 7. Genesis chapter 7, if we read it for what it is the systematic destruction of the world itself and the death of every single human and all air-breathing, land-dwelling creatures. Can't think of anything worse than that than us killing our Lord and Savior. So if we think about the text for what it is, Genesis chapter 7 is the sequential, systematic destruction of the world. So that by the time we get through towards the end of that chapter, we see that all the high mountains under the whole heavens were covered to a depth of more than 20 feet, of course, measured in cubits. And after that, we have the phrase, only Noah was left and those with him on the ark. The image that you are given in your mind is one of a lonely boat on an endless, vast sea that never finds land. And Noah would still not find land for a good long time after that. In fact, I went through and I circled every one of, and I hope it's every, because I'm trying to say that it's every one of the every, all, and everything statements that we find from Genesis 6, chapter 1, chapter 6, verse 1, through 9:17. And we can see that it's a lot. There are over 60 instances of all, every, and everything. There are also a number of other instances I didn't circle of things like only. So the exclusatory language is also being used here for things. Like only Noah was left and those with him on the ark. So sooner or later, and I don't know where this line is, but sooner or later we transition away from hyperbole into emphasis, right? You go from the end of the book of Acts when Luke tells us that the gospel was turning the whole world upside down, right? And that's true, except he didn't really mean the entire world because he certainly knew that India was out there and they hadn't gotten it yet. Okay, so there is a role for hyperbole in the language that is being used. But this is not hyperbole. This is your mother telling you that every day the trash has to go out. That's what my mother told me. Every day, Mom, there are two bins at the bottom. There's little cans. That's, I don't care. They have to go out. Why? Because the trash goes out every day. Every, all, every, everything. Sooner or later, you are impressed by the text itself that this is the way that I must read it. Right? We can't be postmodernists about this and just say, as Dr. Wilson had mentioned so nicely yesterday, it's all metaphor. No, this is not all metaphor. There's a particular point that we are intended as readers and intended as hearers to understand out of this. In the New Testament, we likewise find that the flood's totality is completely and utterly affirmed in every place that the flood is mentioned. From the words of our own Lord and Savior, talking about in the days of Noah, it's going to be like that when I return again. A comparison of the effect of the entire world to what will be the effect on the entire world when he returns and the kingdom of God begins, or the kingdom of God is ushered in its fullest. But also in the works of Peter. Three times in Peter's two short epistles, he uses the flood to illustrate theological points, and those theological points rely on the flood being first, a real event in history and time, and second, an event that is completely and totally global. We see that he uses creation and the flood and the return of Jesus Christ as a threefold parallelism. And so if you believe that the creation is universal, which it kind of has to be, God makes everything, then he destroys the world, and then he comes back to rule and judge the world, and nothing escapes his judgment, then it makes sense that Peter's logic for this is built upon two events that were universal and global in their effect. So both the Old Testament and the New Testament authors are in complete concert and agreement that everything except for Noah, his family, and those that were on the ark that were land-dwelling, air-breathing organisms were killed during the flood. Those were the only ones that made it. The flood is directly compared with creation. Christ's return is judgment, and so we are left with a global flood. So when the church has looked at this for 2,000 years, and when the Jews have looked at this for centuries, 1,000 years before that, there's no surprise at the interpretation that they came to. It's not something that we as moderns all of a sudden have discovered something that was hidden. No, this was plain for all to see. Not only on the surface reading of the text, but also as we dig down deeper, which I won't do here today, but if we dig down deeper into the text, we will find massive numbers of parallels between the flood and the creation account in Genesis chapter 1. To understand the flood account, you must thoroughly understand what's going on in creation. You'll see the same words, the same phrases, the promises that are made to Noah reflect the promises that are made to Adam. Noah is intended by the writer to help us understand that we're starting all over again. Noah is not the second Adam. That's Jesus. But Noah is a type. He is a form of an Adam because we're beginning the world over again. So this leaves us now to start to ponder what goes on with geology. With geology, we've got all these beautiful rock exposures. I get to drive around here in Pittsburgh and see gorgeous rock exposures all over the place. Every time I see shale, I'm thinking there's probably plant fossils in there that I don't have time to get right now. But I want to, and it's raining, which means probably nobody else would be trying to get them, so there might be good pickings. So the geological record, including all the fossils that are in them, is a record either of recent creation and the flood. Those are the two major events geologically in the history of the world from a biblical and, I believe, young Earth perspective, or it's going to be a record of billions of years of geological activity over time. That may or may not include evolution as part of it, because there are certainly Christians who think that the Earth is ancient, but God was not using evolution. There are also Christians who believe that the Earth is ancient and God was using evolution, and there's young Earth. So we have a wide variety within Christendom as far as the perspectives on this. But this is forcing a choice, at least here, on the time issue. Is the Earth young, and therefore the geology is primarily a creation week and a flood record, or is the Earth immensely old, and we happen to be just sitting on top of all this most very recent stuff at the very top of the rest? So we've got these funny words that we use in the geological column, things like Proterozoic, meaning before life. There are some forms of life in the deepest rocks over here, but it's mostly algae and bacteria and things like that. And then we get into these three units, the Paleozoic, the Mesozoic, and the Cenozoic. We've probably heard about the Mesozoic because it's got the dinosaurs of Jurassic Park and, you know, things like that in it. So we got ancient life, middle life, and new life. And this threefold division of the fossil record that we are familiar with actually goes back early in the history of geology when it was first named primary, secondary, and tertiary, as people were thinking that these were the rocks that were laid down early during the flood, late during the flood, and either the latest flood or after the flood, which is very interesting because we'll actually be circling back around to that viewpoint again. So in a modern young Earth conception, we recognize at least a good number of these rocks as being formed during the flood, which means that we have some rocks that were formed during creation week and some rocks that were also formed by more localized catastrophes after the flood was done. And I and my egghead friends get to argue about where we draw these lines, and we do that at our conventions and our meetings. But for these purposes, you're with me, so I'm right. And so the end of the Mesozoic here, end of the last occurrence of dinosaur fossils, for example, is where I think that is probably a good place to figure where the end of the flood was, and that the Cenozoic, the age of mammals in most of our textbook, is actually the recolonization of the world in the post-flood period. Now, these same exact rocks, the exact same rocks that are standing in this beautiful cliff face across the way from us here in Pittsburgh, are recognized by my colleagues in geology as part of a deep geological history that begins 4.5 billion years ago and brings us to the present. So the only place where I and a colleague of mine in geology will agree is that we're both here in the present. I mean, it's good that we agree there, right? If not, we're in even worse trouble than we thought. But as you can see now, we've got the same rocks and we've got very, very different interpretive schemes for them. And so you can't say that God, you know, put a flood in the world and destroyed the dinosaurs, but it was 150 million years ago. That doesn't quite work on the time scale here. So what happened historically is that in the late 17 and early 1800s, the first tremors of this coming from within Christendom in particular, from places like Germany and England, is that geologists started finding for the first time organisms that were extinct. Now, we take extinction for granted because we can go to the Carnegie Museum over here in Pittsburgh, and I certainly recommend that you do. It's a beautiful, beautiful natural history museum. And we can see all the dinosaurs. We can go to the Smithsonian. We can go to the LA County Museum. We can go all these places and observe for ourselves the things that have been found in the Earth. But extinction was a new concept in 1780. It was something that people were wrestling with because they believed in what was called the principle of plentitude. They believed that God's creation was filled and that God would never allow any of his creations to actually completely die off of the earth. In my home state of Virginia now, where I teach at Liberty University, we even find Thomas Jefferson held to this principle. As he sent Lewis and Clark out on their expedition, he wrote in a letter to them that he was hoping that they would find some of the great mastodons and saber-toothed tigers and other extinct Ice Age animals somewhere out where Oregon is. Wherever out there, Jefferson was hoping that they were still there because Jefferson was still holding to a principle of plentitude. Well, that idea of extinction was quite jarring. And as people started discovering things in the rocks down below that didn't correspond to anything that's alive on land or in the seas today, they started to grapple with, what do we do with Genesis? And their response was to take Noah's flood, and instead of having it start way down here, they moved the bottom of Noah's flood and said, well, maybe it starts up higher. Maybe it starts up higher. Maybe we have to put it above all of these other things that don't exist around here anymore. Maybe we'll only put it where we have human fossils and human record. And what they found is that as you tried to do that, William Buckland was one of the last ones holding on to this idea, is that eventually the evidence for a global flood disappeared entirely. As soon as Buckland was able to be convinced that ice was what had moved all the big boulders and gravels that were littering New England and that were littering northern England, and that they weren't found in other sorts of places, he realized, wait a minute, that's an ice age that has nothing to do with flowing, moving water in liquid phase. He was the last one to say, that's it, Noah's flood has to be a local event. It obviously isn't global because the rocks that we're looking at don't have any evidence. I would submit that the problem is that they moved the boundary all the way up into the post-flood world. And in the post-flood world, you're not going to find evidence of a global flood. It's done. It's over. And so this idea of extinction drove them at the time. And I understand the logic. I understand why they did it, even though I believe it was incorrect. But it drove them to move these rocks around and say, let's look for it in a different place. But as a result of those actions, what they did is they said that Noah's flood never existed, and now we're going to have to radically reinterpret the way that we understand Genesis. And so this is also going on at the same time that we see the rise of higher criticism in Germany, and all of these things are starting to work against the Bible at that time, work against it as a text that we can trust. Instead, everything is being called into question. But we can still question. It is the job of the scientist to ask questions of the world around us and to see if we can glean information from it and ask the Lord to give us wisdom and understanding and knowledge so that we might be able to not only learn, but learn to interpret properly the world around us. So two questions that any model of Noah's flood has got to ask and answer, at least initially, before it can even get off the ground. And my apologies to the grammarians here. From whence did the waters come? I have to apologize to my English students as well in class. But nevertheless, let's face it, where'd the water come from? If we're going to flood the world, how do you get the water? And you have to answer the second question. This has been more difficult for young earth creationism over the decades. Where does it go when the flood is over? How come we're not still standing underneath a mile of water right now? Because we could be. And if you don't have a mechanism to give us the water and you don't have a mechanism to take the water away, then your flood story just don't float. Right? Just doesn't hold water. So it's terrible. It's terrible. It's like this every class. It's also reading the church curmudgeon. So, you know, it's bad stuff for those of you who know about him. Anyway, so tectonics and the flood. I'm going to argue here that the flood is effectively a geological activity. It is a tectonic event that involves the movements of the tectonic plates in order to provide us with an answer for how we get the water for the flood and answer those two questions. So we have to do a little bit of science here. And for those, how many of you are science teachers? Okay, quite a few. Great, great. How many of you teach earth science in particular? Okay, and you know, in different grades, hit on a few things. So we have something called the lithosphere. Lithosphere, lithos, stone, rock, right? And sphere, domain. So the domain of rock is a group of mobile units that are composed of some of the upper mantle and the crust. So it's the crust that we walk on and a little bit of the mantle below the earth as well. And they are fixed together and they move around with respect to one another. So image from the textbook, I make my students memorize this and draw it out because you got it. If you're going to take an earth science class, you don't know what the inside of the earth looks like, you fail. And I fail if you don't know that. So we have the lithosphere. Here's our crust, continental crust. Ocean crust is much thinner, but sits down a little bit slower. That's going to be important later on. And then we have a little bit of the mantle here connected. So when geologists talk about plate tectonics, they're talking about this group of rocks that are operating together as a functional unit here. Also fun to tell my students is that we've never actually taken a direct sample of the mantle. So we've never, you know, and they're like, well, how do you know what it is? That's a whole other lecture. It's tons of fun. It's all about earthquakes and other sorts of stuff. But we basically listen to the earth. Things go boom in the earth. They send sound waves. We start figuring out what goes on inside. It's really pretty neat. We get some fun chemistry, too. So the Earth's surface is divided into roughly a dozen large plates and then scores upon scores of tiny or small plates in the midst of these sorts of things. And they're all moving right now slowly with respect to one another, but plate tectonics helps us understand a whole lot of the geological features that we see of the planet, as well as a lot of the geographic features that are tied to that geology. So some patterns. It started becoming clear to some people that the continents may not have always been in the same place. The first person to recognize this was Antonio Ortelius. Some of you historians might know him as the father of cartography. He started the first atlas of the world, and he developed the five-color system that we use for all of our maps. And so we haven't changed that since the mid-1500s. He started getting in reports of coastlines. He was from the Netherlands, so he was getting a lot of information from all the shipping trade coming in and out of the Netherlands, and he started developing maps. And he noticed that the coastlines of North America and South America looked like they could sort of maybe fit against Europe and Africa if you squinted just right. And he thought that maybe there were some earthquakes or some violent catastrophes that moved us apart over time, and he just left it at that. The next person to talk about it was Antonio Snyder Pellegrini, who was a catastrophist and questionably young Earth creationist. It's not entirely clear where he stood on the age of the Earth. But nonetheless, he was working in the early 1800s, mid-1800s. He published his book on effectively what we now call continental drift, but he believed that there was a rapid rupture that had happened between creation week and the flood. He was trying to explain how the Native Americans got to North America, and he held to a local flood that he thought killed off everybody and then was reseeded by the population after the flood in the Old World, but he was trying to figure out where the Native Americans stood because those aren't listed in the Table of Nations. So he thought, well, maybe they're descendants of Adam, but this split apart, and so the Native Americans, in his view, are descendants of Adam, but not descendants of Noah. A fascinating approach. Again, he's wrestling with these discoveries and trying to figure out how do you do this and yet maintain some sort of faithful view of the Bible. I don't think he was successful, but he starts saying there was all this evidence that the continents had moved. The problem was he published his book in 1858 and 1859. There was another important science book published in 1859. More people paid attention to it. A guy named Darwin, kind of important. And also, he was a catastrophist. He believed that there were massive, sudden, rapid changes in Earth history, and that was fading as a dominant viewpoint in geology. Uniformitarianism, the idea of slow, steady, gradual stuff, that was on the rise. And so he was a man behind his times. And so nobody read his stuff. He couldn't even get it published in English at first. He had to publish it in French. The English edition came out in 1859. But he noticed some things, and then Alfred Wegener would be the person in the early 20th century who would really start putting literally the pieces together. But there was very good evidence that Wegener never read Snyder Pellegrini's work because Pellegrini had some great arguments for the connection between North America and Europe, and Wegener didn't have any of that. Most of his evidence focused on what was going on in the southern continents, Africa, South America, India, Antarctica, and Australia. And Wegener would have loved to have had more information about what was going on in Europe and North America, would have made his argument much more powerful, but apparently he never knew of the writings of his predecessor. So anybody who's played around with a globe and said, God, are you going to make me a missionary here? Right. I guess I was the only one who did that in Sunday school. we all recognize that there's a certain fit of the continents, but there was a counter argument to that, and that was that the fit was only apparent. If you actually take South America and Africa, looking at the coastlines as we have them, and we put them there, South America is too small by about 20%. It does not fit. There wouldn't be an answer to that challenge for another 30 years after Wegener was making the argument. So there was a counter argument. Matching mountain chains across the Atlantic Ocean, similar fossils. We'll take a look at these visually here. So actually, we'll go with the mountain chains here first. The Appalachian Mountains, how many of you have hiked on the Appalachian Trail? Wow, quite a few of you, awesome. I haven't done the whole thing because I'm not that kind of guy, but I've hiked on in a couple of spots up and down in Virginia, in Vermont, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts. Canada asked if their Nova Scotian Highlands could be incorporated into the Appalachian Trail in 1997, I believe, and that was granted permission. So actually you have to take a ferry if you want to keep going through and do the entire Appalachian Trail. But then a group of Scots said, hey, we've got the Scottish Highlands. We want to be part of the Appalachian Trail. We said, dude, you wear kilts? No, we can't do that. Folks up in Scandinavia said, we want the Scandinavian mountains to be part of the Appalachian Trail. Your mountains have trolls. So no, that doesn't work. And then Morocco says the Atlas Mountains need to be part of the Appalachian Trail. And you say, guys, you're in Africa. There's just no way. right? Except for when you put the continents back together again, the trend line is that they are all a unified orogeny. That's a geology name for a mountain building event. So they're all made up of mostly the same kinds of rocks at the same basic time, and they all fall on a nice linear trend. And if you're a science teacher and your kids all plot out the data and it all goes online, you're happy, right? You don't know why it did it, because they obviously didn't do it right. They just faked it, right? Science fair is tough. But nonetheless, there's an argument here. Now, the counter-argument is, yeah, but there's actually a whole bunch of different types of stuff going on with these mountains. You've got granitic mountains down over here. You've got fold mountains over here. You've got more granite down there. Yeah, it looks good, but it's not as good as you think. And I can take the continents, I can put them different ways. And I can come up with a different set. And so the argument that Wegener was constructing was being criticized as being ad hoc. Okay. Wegener said, but there's fossils. And when you put the fossils, it turns out that they could actually exist across places like India. This very unfortunate looking reptile, it looks kind of like a pig mated, I don't know, with an alligator that got thrown against the back of a bus. I mean, it's really not a happy looking creature, called Lystrosaurus. It's not a swimmer. It's this big and fat, and it's just not going to swim. And yet it's found on the continents of India and Africa and Antarctica, as well as Australia. But there were counter arguments as well. Current systems and rafted vegetation mats can actually move organisms across ocean gyres. There could have been land bridges across these sorts of things. So point, counterpoint, all going on through Wegener. And Wegener dies in the 1930s without very much progress. The people in the southern continents actually like it a lot. It's Europe and North America that really don't like it. And that's because in North America, you can explain the Appalachian Mountains very well with continental drift, but you can't explain the Rockies. Can't explain the Cascades. You can't explain anything in California, even geologically. It's really hard to do no matter what, never mind politically. But anyway, so if you can't explain two-thirds of North American geology, North American geologists are not going to buy into the idea. And so there was a lot of resistance against Wegener's hypotheses. It would come back later with more evidence, especially evidence about the ocean floors. But here's the evidence from earthquakes. Right? Yep, there's the Ring of Fire. Johnny Cash is in our minds. And the Ring of Fire is circum-Pacific area. And all these places are where we've got earthquakes over the course of the 20th century. This is a map of all the earthquakes that were recorded of magnitude 4.0 or larger from 1900 to 1999. And so the pattern's not random. Right? This is not a random association of dots. There's nothing happening in northern, well, there's never anything happening in northern Canada. But you know, geologically, it's quiet. Right? Geologically, Africa's really quiet. Northern Europe is very quiet. It also reminds me, when I think about when Jesus said, he was asked by his disciples, what is it going to be like at the end, you know, when your kingdom comes? And he says, well, there's going to be wars and rumors of wars, and then there's going to be earthquakes in various places. Oops. Trying not to die here. Right over in here, there's not a whole lot of dots noted, but that's a very tectonically active area, the Jordan Rift. There's a reason why the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee are right there with the Jordan River. It's because there's actually a transform, a movement of the rocks this way and this way with a little bit of expansion that creates a valley and gives us the deepest, you know, the deepest area on the surface of the earth at the Dead Sea. So actually, there's plenty of earthquakes around where Jesus was, but our Christian heritage goes largely through Europe, which doesn't have a whole lot of geological activity, doesn't have a whole lot of earthquakes. And then we move from Europe to the Americas, and as you can see, not a whole lot going on in the East Coast. So our views of something like when Jesus says there will be earthquakes in various places, to the disciples, they've experienced earthquakes. Now, it means that there's still going to be problems. Earthquakes are never considered happy occurrences, right? But at the same time, our view perhaps that this means that the whole world is going to be shaking, it might be a little bit off. It comes from the fact that our Christian heritage goes through a very geologically quiescent area over time. So it's part of what really tipped the scales in the 1960s towards plate tectonics was the discoveries of a whole bunch of stuff involving the ocean floor. And that was people like Harry Hess, who's a submariner, a rear admiral for the United States Navy. And he put down some very, very risky hypotheses and said, if the sea ocean crust has actually moved, I predict this will be the case. If the ocean crust has never moved, we would predict this to be the case. Go find it. And the answer came back resoundingly that the seas must have been a conveyor belt with new magma rising at the surface, tracking away from what are called the ocean ridges. And so we now know that the cross-section, say, through the Pacific Ocean, this would be something like Japan. We have the deep ocean trench just off the coast of Japan, and you have something like Mount Fuji as a volcanic mountain poking right up through here. This is the reason why they had such a huge tsunami 6 years ago. It's because of a lock that had built up over here, and then eventually that released and sent massive amounts of a rock kind of popped up at the bottom of the ocean, sending a tsunami wave. It was only 20 minutes warning that they had for that tsunami. It was devastating. This would be something like the Hawaiian Islands. We've got a hot spot coming from much deeper in the Earth, probably closer to the mantle, rising all the way up through and then just kind of slashing its way through the crust. And this is why there's only one Hawaiian island that has an active volcano. All the others have actually been moved and shifted away from the spot of the rising magma, and so you get to something like Kauai. It's beautiful, and you don't have to worry about dying, right? It's going to be on the Big Island where you're going to find some geologist wearing a suit made of tinfoil poking lava with a stick, right? And you're like, okay, why is he doing that? Well, volcanologists have the shortest life expectancy of all geology trades. Just saying. And then over on this side, we have something like the Cascade Mountains with Mount St. Helens over here. Again, what we call a subduction zone where ocean crust is going down, causing melting, causing us to have the really nasty types of things. You can poke lava with a stick over here because you know, it's generally quiet lava just kind of flowing and oozing. This is the stuff that gets all locked up and forms massive explosions. Mount Fuji, same way. This is why I live in Virginia. We're like way over here and there's nothing. I love it. It's geologically nice and quiet, except for a nice rumble we had in 2011. What this tells us, though, is if the ocean crust has moved, if the continents have moved, that means that the world that God created was a very different one than the one that we have. The geography is totally different, right? I teach with students. The geology is whack, right? It's nuts. Where's North America on this? I don't know. Well, okay, I'm a geologist. I do know. But at the same time, we have to start thinking of the world as fundamentally and radically different. This is not Pangaea that you hear about in the earth science textbook. This is before Pangaea. Pangaea is something that actually happens during the flood. It's mostly underwater the whole time. Interesting. So the created world was a different sort of place. We probably had no big ocean ridges. There was probably no big plate movements, because what we get from the picture of creation in Genesis chapter 1, that when God finishes making this world and he makes it very good, he tells the animals that they are to eat plants just as we were told to eat plants as well. You look back and go, wait a minute, it's not supposed to be carnivory going on? We get this sense of a world that is in harmony with itself, that reflects its creator in a beautiful sort of way that doesn't involve death and bloodshed. So that probably means also geologically we're dealing with a world that's fairly quiet. We're not going to have massive volcanic eruptions and things like that, because those would be considered natural evils, I think, that wouldn't be part of that initial very good creation. So how do we explain then the movements of the continents? Because if the continents are currently moving at a rate of only a few centimeters per year, and the ocean crust is only moving at a few centimeters per year, that's not enough to get things to move in a one-year-long flood. Okay. So in 1994, some colleagues of mine, Dr. Steve Austin, Kurt Wise, John Baumgartner, Andrew Snelling, Larry Vardaman, and Russ Humphreys proposed what is now called catastrophic plate tectonics at the International Conference on Creationism in 94. This envisions not a continental drift, but a continental sprint, a rapid movement of the continents during the flood. And Baumgartner's geophysical modeling of this, his 3D computational approaches, show that these movements can actually get our plates moving very, very fast enough to cover the distances that we need within the period of time of the flood, which is a little over 1 year. So what this means is if we start off with a geologically quiescent world, the flood begins with the onset of subduction. Again, subduction is when the ocean crust starts sinking down into the mantle. In some places where the ocean crust is very far away from the rising magma at what we call the ocean ridges, that crust is actually more dense than the mantle immediately below, which is an interesting issue, right? When you've got something that's more dense sitting over something that's less dense, all you need is a little bit of a kick in order to get them to start to try and change places. So even in the modern world, we see that, and that is what is helping continue on plate tectonics that got initiated during Noah's flood. So the flood begins with the first break that starts sending ocean crust down into the mantle. And this creates eventually a break, because rock is very strong. If I had a block of rock just the size of a couple of bricks and I put it on the floor here, I could stack hundreds, thousands of pounds on top of it before it would break. But if I took that same rock and I held it in the air and I suspended thousands of pounds from it on either side, it would snap very, very easily. Rock is very brittle when you try and pull it. It's very good on compressional stress. Tension is very, very bad. So if you start pulling the ocean crust in one direction and bringing it down the mantle, some other place you're pulling the ocean crust and bringing it down in the mantle, sooner or later you're going to break. And once you do, you're going to break, and the ocean crust is about 5 miles thick, 3 to 5 miles thick. That's a lot of rock. And when you take that rock and you break it and you expose effectively the mantle underneath, the mantle will respond by partial melt. Not all of the mantle will melt, but part of it will melt, and that melted material will come up and it'll actually start making new ocean crust. The reason that ocean crust looks the same everywhere on Earth is because it's all derived from parts of the mantle, which is pretty uniform underneath us. So it's not isolated volcanoes like we have on the continents that are mixtures of mantle magmas as well as the continental material that they go through. Instead, the ocean crust is actually just made of partially melted mantle. So as the ocean crust sinks, it cracks, creating an ocean ridge. And this sinking of the old ocean crust starts to create a runaway. So for those of you who teach physics, you think about feedback mechanisms. And we have positive feedback mechanisms and negative feedback mechanisms. The positive feedback mechanisms, you start a push, and by the time the feedback mechanism gets around, it's pushing even harder, right? And pushing even harder. It's like if I stood here, I got too close to the speaker, we'd get the feedback, right? But what would I do in order to stop that? I'd step away, and it would be a positive feedback again to reduce the noise, reduce the noise, reduce the noise, reduce the noise. So when it comes to the issues here with catastrophic plate tectonics, once the ocean crust begins to sink down, it starts melting because it starts getting very hot. But that melting allows it to be lubricated, which allows it to slide a little bit quicker. And then it starts hitting more rock and starts generating more heat, allowing it to melt and slide faster and faster. And once you get gravitationally this stuff going down, it's just going to keep pulling the rest of the ocean crust with it, which is allowing more ocean crust to be formed. These super hot magmas rise and hit the bottom of the ocean floor. So Noah doesn't know what's going on here. I'm not saying that you can open your page of your Bible to Genesis chapter 7 and discover catastrophic plate tectonics. The Bible is intended to tell us about what's going on with the flood, and it tells us what Noah can see. And he knows that the fountains of the great deep burst and the windows of heaven were opened. And I believe that both of these are caused ultimately by these tectonic activities, particularly in the oceans. So I'm a very bad motivational speaker. This is what I have: 4 awful ways to flood the world. I'm going to turn this into a book and make my couple bucks. So during catastrophic plate tectonics, the water from the ocean moves over the continents in 4 different ways. The first is, as that new ocean crust is being made by the rising magma at that crack point, the temperature of that magma is about 1,200 degrees centigrade. Okay, that's a lot hotter than your oven goes, right? That's going to melt your neighborhood. But that hits the bottom of the ocean and flash boils a whole bunch of water and sends columns of steam and boiling water up into the atmosphere, probably about as high as the stratosphere, so several thousands of feet up into the atmosphere. The subduction, and so that what that's going to do is give us our first rain. So when the flood begins and we have this onset of 40 days and 40 nights of intense rain, the Hebrew word for that is this one up over here called geshem. And geshem is a less usual name for rain. It's not the most common word for name. It's probably used more frequently for the seasonal monsoonal rains that would happen in the springtime. Okay, so for us, a good translation for geshem might be something like downpour. So the first time that we see this mentioned in the Bible, it's different from in Genesis chapter 2 in the garden. When there had not yet been rain upon the earth, that's the regular word for rain. First time that we see this, it's geshem. We have a downpour. So I'm not convinced that there was no rain before the flood. Right? There's just not a whole lot of stuff that's being talked about between creation and the fall. We've got, you know, genealogies that very quickly move us through about 1,600 years worth of time. No weather reports along the way. So we have geysers that are providing us with the geshem. We also have subduction of the ocean crust that is going to start to drag the edges of the continents down. It's kind of like when you were a kid and you saw a conveyor belt and they didn't have the little finger guards yet. You sometimes put your fingers on those and just feel that little pinch, right? Because we're suckers for punishment. We're fallen individuals, right? We're depraved. So we put our fingers there, and we can kind of feel that finger pulled down. Well, that's, of course, why they put the finger guards down there, so you don't lose your tie or, you know, and then the rest of you down there. But the continents themselves, as this subduction is going on, is actually pulling them down Now, the continents are too buoyant. They're much more light. They're less dense than the ocean crust is. So it's kind of like putting your finger on an ice cube. You can push that ice cube down, but as soon as you let the pressure up, the ice cube pops back up to its normal spot. That's what's happening with the continents. They're being pulled down by this subduction, and then occasionally they bob back upward, and they might collide as well during plate tectonics. We also have the new ocean crust that's being formed. That new ocean crust is less dense than the stuff that God made initially that is now being subducted and lost. And so as a result, the bottom of the ocean is actually being elevated by the new material. If we've got 3 to 5 miles worth of rock that is being replaced, the new rock is actually about 4 to 6 miles. So we've actually added probably about a half mile, I should say, about a half mile or more of new rock. It's like taking the bottom of your bathtub and putting a little inflatable on it, and you inflate it. Now that bathtub that was up to here is up to your nose. And in the bathtub, it spills over the side. But if you're on the Earth, there's no place for it to spill. It just goes higher and higher and higher. Between just these two, the subduction by the ocean crust and the new ocean crust that's being formed, we're probably looking at about a mile and a half worth of elevation rise to the oceans. And that is enough to flood the world. There's also the warming of the ocean water itself, the basic physics. As temperatures get higher, materials expand, but that's probably only giving us about 10 meters or something like that of total size. So in a schematic cross-section, we saw the subduction before, so we've got the subduction going on through here. We have a drag down of the continents that is bringing them down, allowing the ocean water to invade deeper and deeper inland. We have lots of tsunamis that are going to be bringing in additional waves because all of this activity is not smooth. Right? This is not a well-oiled machine. This is the Earth destroying itself as God intended it to do. And so that means that all the friction results in tsunamis along these areas, the giant plumes and geysers all acting in concert. Now, feedback mechanisms are interesting because a positive feedback mechanism will keep going as long as there's energy to keep it running. But sooner or later, you always run out of energy for the positive feedback mechanism, and you hit a negative feedback mechanism, and the negative one starts to balance things out. Right? So a good example is daytime temperatures. Temperatures start to rise. Air starts to rise, clouds form, clouds bounce back light, reducing temperature in the shade, right? Negative feedback reaction. The warmer it gets, the more clouds we make, which reduces the temperature, which then dissipates the clouds, which then allows the warm temperatures to rise. So you get this play back and forth. Sooner or later, we run out of energy to do this. And once that happens, subduction rates start slowing, right? As the new ocean crust finally starts being subducted, it's resistant to doing so because it's more buoyant. It's newer, it's less dense, it's not as cold. And so it resists subduction. So if it's resisting subduction, that means that the spreading rates over here are going to be much slower, which means we're not going to get as much magma, which means we're not going to get as much water, which means that as this starts to slow down, the continents have a chance to relax and go back up again. So this process will eventually exhaust itself, and the continents will bob back up again. So interestingly enough, I'll just skip to this here, the answer to our question is that the waters to destroy the Earth came from the oceans primarily. We don't need a cosmic set of water. We don't need a vapor canopy. We don't need some of these other ideas in creationism that we've tried but have never really been very satisfactory. Instead, we have a mechanism to take the waters that we have on the Earth already in the form of the oceans, to push them over the lands, and then eventually tectonics slows down and it draws them back. So where are the waters that flooded us? They're still with us. Like so many things as God's reminders to us, they are still here with us if we have the eyes to see and the ears to hear the message that's been given. So because of the flood, none of the continents are in the same positions anymore. And as I mentioned, even Pangaea that we hear about from Wegener's evidences, and he was the one who coined the term Pangaea, is a pre-flood is not the pre-flood continental configuration. It is a flood-created supercontinent that splits and pushes out in the later stages of the flood to get us to where we are today. So also, this means that the types of mountains that were formed by the collision of Pangaea, which would be the Appalachians. Sorry, I'm in the south now. They say Appalachians down there. Appalachians, north of the Mason-Dixon, where I'm originally from. Those were formed during Noah's flood and eroded quickly during Noah's flood. They're not very big when you compare them to the Rockies or the Himalayas, which formed late in Noah's flood and therefore still look younger and more fresh. They have certainly eroded a lot, but they haven't eroded nearly as much. So the difference between then and now is a stark one. Because if we read the passages of Genesis properly, we already know that it is a totally new world when Noah steps off. God has completely destroyed the world using itself, and now we have got an idea of maybe how that could have happened. Now, this is a scientific hypothesis, which means that it needs more testing, it needs more work, it needs more approaches, and it could be wrong. Right? I just don't know yet what parts are. You know, it's kind of the fun of science. I have colleagues at Liberty University say, I'm going to, you know, what I'm teaching you, 50% of it's going to be wrong. The problem is I just don't know which 50%. Okay. You know, because if you're in the new, you know, new thing in genetics and you're learning a whole bunch of new stuff, it's like, hey, it's changing really fast and we're learning new stuff. But there are some things that we know pretty darn well. So it reminds us then that the judged world, the one that we live in, is very different. Because of the flood now, geological catastrophes are actually somewhat common. And with the ability for us to pull out our smartphones and, you know, watch CNN and Fox News, we can find out about all the geological catastrophes that are happening all over the place. And again, we should be reminded, not that I can say and play prophet here and say that because Haiti had an earthquake, it was a judgment of God because of paganism. I don't know that. But what I do know is that that earthquake is a reverberation of a judgment that was made because all the thoughts of man were only evil all the time. That's what God said of us in Genesis chapter 6. All the thoughts of man were only evil all the time. In a theologically proper way, it is a damning critique of humanity. God said that his heart was full of pain, and he regretted that he had made man. But nonetheless, Noah found favor in his sight. Noah was a righteous man, and so there would be grace, as there always is. So that Japanese tsunami, I just finished teaching about earthquakes and tsunamis with my earth science class, and this hit right before our spring break. And so I spent most of spring break watching the news. And this, I used to like watching disaster films. Right? Good geological disaster movie, bad geological disaster movie like The Core. That one's terrible. Once you know geology, it's horrible. It's really bad. I know geologists who use that as an extra credit activity, what make their students watch it. As many, you know, you get 1 point for every error that you can find in the movie. You rack them up real fast. But I watched the news, and then I watched the movie 2012 right after that. And I never quite, 2012 is a difficult movie to enjoy because John Cusack's not a great action hero. But anyway, one of the things that I did come away with, because my wife is smarter than I in a lot of ways, she said one of the things that those movies do that is very helpful is they help to orient us into a way that we might be able to appreciate what the flood was like. 2012 is effectively a Noah's flood story. You know, people are we're going to have a massive sea level rise. People are building giant arks and putting animals on it and preserving and all that. So there's a huge biblical motif throughout the entire film. It's intended to be there. But the computer animations help us to understand, and the ability to see, you know, what happens to buildings and the massive destruction, the utter leveling and destruction of things, is something that we can do in the movies, thankfully, and not have to, you know, deal with here. But it can give us some ideas of what it was like when those fountains broke and when the windows of heaven were opened. And we can recognize also that our God is faithful, because what he promised to Noah in Genesis chapter 9 is never again will the waters become a flood. This is a mabul. Again, this is not a normal flood. In fact, it should be translated as the flood, hamabul here. We'll never bring a flood of waters upon the earth again. If the flood was a local event that affected Mesopotamia and the people that lived there and decimated their area, but, you know, was really kind of just a moral of the story kind of tale for us, then this promise makes no sense. Not only to humans, but also as you go through and you read this, 8 times the promise is made to humans, and 7 times, I believe, it is made to animals. To the beasts of the earth, to the birds of the air, everything that creeps upon the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, God makes this same promise. And if the flood is a local event that only affects Mesopotamia, then the kangaroos don't get this. They can't get this. And that promise of the bow in the sky that I hope to see when the sun comes out someday over here, right, makes no sense to the animals of North America, to the people of North America, to the people of Siberia and the animals in southern Africa, if this was not a global event. If it was a global event, then God's promise has been kept to all of his creation for the centuries. That's the God we serve. And with that, I thank you for your attention. Thank you for spending some time with me. If you're interested in chatting with me more about this, I'm going to be over at the booth just right above our heads here at Cornerstone Educational Supply. I'd be happy to chat with you. And for those of you who are science teachers, we have a gathering over at the Three Rivers Lounge at 3:15. I'm going to be asking and picking your brains about what classical educators would like for a science series for high school. So if you've got ideas, what would the book of your dreams look like? Come see me at 3:15. I'll be over in the lounge. Soft drinks are on me. Lord bless you. Thank you very much.
Hey. Is there a president's reception tonight that my secretary responded to, or was there something?
That was last night.
So an error was made.
Yes, I must do one. That's okay. I'd love to get together with
you. Okay.
Are you helping me here?
Well, I'm here till really early tomorrow morning.
Okay. So we just want to get that.
Do you want to? That was my fear when talking to other. Let's do that right now.
Yes, that would be good.
Because I think in talking to Greg yesterday, we have a product that can help. The product's the wrong word. A cooperative program that can help our schools.
Are you speaking
four o'clock?
Four o'clock. So maybe we can do it between this and 4 o'clock.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
At least read about that.
Yeah. That's, no, I know how busy you are. So, and that's why I'm so sorry to have missed that. And that was my fear. It could be that they had the right date, but then shipped it.
Yeah. Well,
or something.
We will be our fault. You can't replace batteries sometimes, right?
Right.
And so now I think.
Lots of good friends that I love. But the one thing I miss from HBU is Linda Clark. was done Saturday was triple booked. And since you're going to go to your daughter's wedding, it wasn't really triple booked. So, those who have been forgiven by.
Okay, well, I'm not sure if I'm thankful or not.
Yes, you should be not thankful.
I just sent you a text.
Okay, great.
Hey, I'm going to make sure you're actually getting this. So, cell phones make up for a multitude of disorganizations.
So, I haven't yet, so maybe I gave you the wrong one. 7.46 or 9.52. What's your number? Yes, I had that. Yep, I just got it. And I had your number. I'll take your picture. Then I can have your picture.
Right after this.
No, I am going to be here for this. That's why I'm here, right? We're hoping to be a part of the accreditation thing next year.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Greetings. Greetings. Wow. We'll hope that works a little better. If you can make your way in, I do have to get going as quickly as possible. Our time is tight. I will. Do I have till 20? Greetings. If everyone could make your way in, I'm going to say a blessing here really quickly for our meal. All right. Let's bow our heads. Our Lord God, we thank you for this opportunity to pray to you, this opportunity to gather together in fellowship and to be together for the purpose of serving you. And I ask your blessing on this food, on the day. We thank you for the rain and ask your blessing
on our afternoon in this meeting. In Jesus' name, amen. Right, thank you. All right. I'm going to get right to it here. This is a tradition we started a few years ago to update membership on what's going on. We continue to try and develop new ways to help you, and I like to try and go through some of these things. We have this year on the agenda, I'm going to go through some of the changes that we've seen over the past year in member services from the ACCS, and then I'm going to show you the brief demo of the new Member Resource Center. So we'll get right to it here. Last year we worked, you saw a rebrand a little bit, and just so you all know what we're doing with that, it wasn't just to make things look different, although the printers were happy with us because our old gradient logo was hard to print. You may have noticed we've kind of rebranded around classicalchristian.org as opposed to ACCS. The main thing there is that we want to help parents who are coming looking for classical education. I think last year, we'll see it in a second, but I think we were right around 90,000 people looking for information on our site about classical education. And of course, an association of classical Christian schools is only as good as the member schools that parents can send their kids to. So what we're trying to do is make it about classical Christian education and direct them to you rather than branding ourselves. So that's a little bit of the idea behind why you'll see more of that logo with classical Christian in it. We also did a web page refresh in January. We'll talk about that briefly. We have done some substantive work in the accreditation and teacher certification area, and we have this what's called in here the Ed System project, but we'll look at that a little bit later. It's been renamed at the behest of our board, but I haven't changed the slides yet. So they don't like the word system, and I agree with them. So we'll get to that. So this is just a little update. We've got 279 full members right now. For those of you who understand our memberships, full members are only schools. We don't have individual memberships. Those are affiliates. We don't have business memberships. Those are affiliates. So the numbers you're seeing here are just K through 12 schools, and we have about 43,000 students in our program right now. Now you may notice that there's a spike over here that isn't over there. Some of the reason why our membership our student numbers are kind of flattening is because we're changing the way we're counting the student numbers. For example, if there was a school that only operated 2 days a week in the past, we were just cutting the number of students in half for their pricing, you know, the cost of membership. We've just reset the pricing so the number of students stays the same and it's accurate. So it's a more accurate number is essentially what I'm saying. That's the reason for the difference. this is just curiosity if you're curious. On the conference history, this goes all the way back to 96. That's as far back as I have records, and you can kind of see how our various cities and the attendance at the conference, we had a spike last year in Atlanta, actually filled for most of you know that, and we've got about 1,080 here, so that's a good number. We're excited to be here in Pittsburgh because it helps the schools nearby. I don't know how many of you are from within 500 miles of here. Raise your hand. Excellent. Well, that's why we do these. We try and get to where you could drive if you wanted to. So another piece of work that we've done in the past year is that it used to be accsedu.org was the center place for just about everything. And we're breaking that up a little bit because what we're trying to do is get the right website for the right visitor. So the first website, the main ACCS website. You've seen that refresh that came out in January. We've had some really good numbers with that. And then the classical difference is more for the parents and interested outsiders, people who are just kicking the tires on classical education. We've got a lot of live content being added to that right now, or not live, but active. It changes every week or so. And you know, of course, the content of the different site changes as the quarterly as the difference is updated. And we have the Member Resource Center, which is on the far right, and the Repairing the Ruins site, and a site that we've been working on, we continue to work on, that in the lower right there, that is more millennial targeted, very few words and a lot of pictures for how classical Christian education works. Hope I didn't insult any millennials. But anyways, most of your kindergartners right now are coming from millennials, so we got to be sure we can communicate with them. By the way, you're always that's at about.classicalchristian.org. You're always welcome to direct link to that from your site if you want to. Just be sure you start another window when you do it so they find their way back to your site afterwards. All right, classical difference update. We have about 15,000 direct subscribers right now. Those are members who've sent in names to us that we send directly to. We print about 18,000 per run. Pretty big for magazines. Trade magazines tend to run a little larger if they're national trade magazines, but that's a pretty good number. Costs us about $15,000 every time we mail it out. We have about 80% of schools participating. This year we did not choose to raise our membership fees, but that's the good news. The difference, however, will cost $1.50 per student in addition to your membership fees, because the grant that was funding it ran out. Now, we still subsidize that as much as we can, and we have a plan to continue seeking grants and trying to make that as affordable as possible, because we want to get it out there. But I did want to let you know that it's an optional $1.50 if you want people to get it, and that's like for all four issues. So that's $1.50 per student for four issues. We're assuming about two students per family, so it actually equates to maybe $3 per family, and it costs us about $4 a year to mail to a family. So we're subsidizing it by about a dollar. So that's what's new with the classical difference. How many of you are currently subscribing your parents to it, if I could get a show of hands? Excellent, excellent. Well, I hope it's helpful. The last two issues, we kind of were struggling with our resources to get both of them going. I think they were good issues, but we're planning on making them better in the future. The reason was the MRC was just getting rolled out, and you'll see in a moment why that was so much work. This is the visits to our website. You see the 90,000. These are users. These aren't like clicks or visits or whatever. These are people, as long as they don't clear their browser cache and they come back to the site, it doesn't count them twice. It's 90,000 people, roughly, just a little less than that. However, you see that the main site has declined a little bit, and the Repairing the Ruins and Classical Difference sites are starting to come up. So we're seeing what we want to see, which is people finding what they need faster and directly. Now, one of the differences we've seen is that the bounce rate on this new site that we built dropped from 48%. That means somebody, if you ever search on classical Christian education, you'll land on our site typically. We are pretty high in the search engine. But people were hitting it, going to it, and then abandoning immediately because there wasn't anything, they couldn't figure out what to do there. So we dropped from 48%, which is pretty mediocre, to 25% when we released the new site. So that means people are finding what they're looking for. So that's a good thing. 25 is actually fairly good in the industry. All of you will be getting new membership collateral as soon as we get through the membership sign-up period. We did change the logo, but I also wanted to make sure that we really help you with the credibility that you're showing to your parents. And of course, that's a lot of times why our members are members, is that they want to show that they're part of this national movement, that it's a commitment to the quality of classical Christian education. And so you'll be getting the center one here. We're actually sending them to you framed. We hope they make them to you in one piece. These are decals that can go on your front door, or some of them are clings and some of them are stickers. They're stickers if they're going on the actual outside of a window or something like that, and the clings are for inside windows. So these will be coming to you probably around September. I wish I could get them to you sooner, but that's about as soon as we'll be able to. And the accreditation plaques have changed a little bit. If you're already accredited, the tough news is we can't afford to replace your plaque right now, but if you want one, you can buy one for yourself. They're a couple hundred bucks a piece, but the point of it is to try and make sure that when parents see it, they understand that this isn't, you know, it's hard to go through the accreditation process. It's a great process, and it really drives excellence into your school, but we want to be sure parents understand just how significant that is, so we're improving some of our collateral materials that we send you. We're also working on some collateral materials that you'll be able to put in your parent packets or whatever that talk about ACCS accreditation and why it's valuable. You may have seen, if you've been by our booth, this, which is a piece for you guys on accreditation. The parent one will be smaller, and it'll be more basic. You know, it's more about what the parent can understand about your accreditation. Because I know there's always questions parents ask you, are you accredited? And you have to contend with, well, it depends on what you mean. I'm not accredited like the public high school across the street. I'm not accredited like the IB school down the road. You know, ACCS accreditation means something pretty specific. So we're going to help you communicate that with some items that are coming probably about the same time frame as these. You can pick this up, which is for schools, trying to attract schools into accreditation. My goal is to get us to 100 accredited schools. We're at about 43 right now, and it'll probably take five or six years to get there. The reason is if we can get, the more schools we can get accredited, the more of a story we have to tell about the value of accreditation for parents. All right, we've also worked on teacher certification, and this comes into what I had defined as ed system before, but it's really a classical Christian education integration, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but part of it is teacher certification. I know when I was a head of school, the first year that we were accredited, as soon as we got our plaque, I got notice that before we get to the next accreditation point, I had to figure out how to certify teachers, and I was going, well, where do I start? I don't know what to do. So we've revamped the teacher certification. It doesn't change anything to put onus on you, but we're providing some more tools that you can use to train your teachers. It does add the requirement of this foundations course that we're recording here. You see some of the equipment. We're going to make it free and as available as possible to you, but the idea is if you're accredited, you'll need to take your teachers through this certification. And I would encourage all of you who are just members to do the same thing, because it'll be a really good program. We're going to record it this year, improve it, record it again next year. It'll be an six-part for any one teacher, because there's two parts that are just for grammar, two parts that are just for upper school. So that's coming as part of teacher certification. So today and what we're announcing right now at the conference is the release of the Member Resource Center, shorthand MRC. Didn't get too clever with the naming. Figured you guys would figure it out. The MRC is a very big deal. And the reason this is a very big deal is in my years as a headmaster, one of the things that I realized was that every time I had to make a decision, I had to start over. Whether it was changing a math curriculum in grammar school, and you guys, many of you who were at last year's presentation saw me talk about this in theory. It's being released right now because we opened it actually in March, but as sort of a soft opening because we've been programming on it since March, trying to get it to work. My commitment to this is to make our resources not only available, but findable quickly, because I know that most of you, your heads of schools, don't have a lot of time to go sorting through a whole bunch of stuff to find what you're looking for. So I'll show you a demo of that right now. I'll talk about a few of these details. So the library is an enhanced searchable library with hundreds of documents, and we've got some additional types of documents we're adding in there. But for example, we've indexed, I think we're back to 5 years now, and we're trying to get back to 10 years on both conference talks and classes articles. And I'm actually surprised. Forgetting how many great classes articles there have been over the years. And so those are all individually, not tied into an issue of classes, but individually searchable and accessible. We'll see that in a minute. The conference talk system used to be a little kludgy and difficult. This is a much easier, fast. I mean, you click on it, you get the MP3. It's not rocket science, unless you don't know what to do with an MP3. Which does challenge me from time to time, but I try to, the MP3s tend to be pretty easy. Yes?
Can you speak up a little?
I'm sorry. Okay. Well, I'm hearing myself really loudly. So I'll move this up. I'll talk louder. Thank you. Great. Teacher, there's a teacher training center, and we'll look at that, and some new curriculum tools. The job exchange has been updated, and there's a marketplace. So I thought the best way to describe this to you is to show you some questions that I would have anticipated getting when I was working in a school. So we'll just start through administrators and teachers, two different places, and we're just going to look at how you can use this tool. Now, if we look at the tool itself, I don't know if it's going to let me do this. I may have to switch like that. The tool itself, if you just land on its front page, has these categories that make it real easy to pick, you know, what you want. But what I'm going to do right now is jump from the slide deck straight into the various areas. So this is what you would normally land on. But if we look at this first one here, the question was, I'm on the roster to do a half an hour of training at the staff meeting. What do I do? And for me, this was usually around 11 a.m. with a staff meeting at about 12. So I don't know if all of you I know are more organized than that. But if you go to our conference talks and audio, this is a customized search engine. So one thing in this version, you have to search the talks. Directly, you can't use the global search because we're still trying to figure out how to integrate the two. So you come into the actual conference talks area, and you can really search on anything. We got 114 loaded up right now. We could search. Maybe we want something from Doug. You're going to get. Let's see. Ryan Evans must have talked about Doug in this talk, and there's one. Beowulf, the other classic. So any of these, you just click on it, and you're going to be listening to it. This is Nate Wilson, of course. And so you can just play it pretty easily, all right? Of course, you won't be able to hear it, but you get the idea. So that's what you do if at 11 you decide you need a conference talk for the teachers to listen to. So let's see what the next problem we have here is. I need 35 desks. Can I get a better deal than searching the internet, right? This was always the thing. We oftentimes don't know where to buy stuff specific for schools. What we haven't done too much in the marketplace is try and solve problems like office supplies, things like that. We know you know how to find those, but it's the weird stuff, right? The field turf or whatever. So if you go into our marketplace, we've added a bunch of stuff, and we've got some budget money to continue adding new products and services in here over the course of time. So hopefully you'll be able to find what you're looking for. If you look on the left side here, you have your browsing by area. So if you really wanted to look at what do you have for athletics, see here, that's the same one. Oh, there's subcategories. So I just brought down the subcategory. Now I got to look at all. And there we go. So what we've done is we've gone out there. Now, what we're not doing is taking any money for anything that's on the MRC. And the reason for that is I don't want to become a market. You know, we're doing this to serve you. We don't want to be paid for it. We want to be able to legitimately put people out there that we think are valuable to you. And we want you to be able to review them or talk about them in the comments below them. If you look at any one of these, let's look at this. This one here, Georgia Mock Trial. This is just a kit you can buy if you want to start a mock trial team, right? And it's put out by Georgia, the state of Georgia, and you can leave a comment here if you want. Now, the comments in the Market Research Center, I'm going to backtrack just a little bit. How do you get on this is part of the question. So one of the things we realized is the old access system of just typing a generic password wasn't going to work for this because of the way it determines who and what you are, you know, who and what you may need. In other words, there's some school-specific information to your school inside this, and so we need to know what school you're with. And so what it does is when you go to the login screen, if you have an email address that the end of it, after the @ sign, is the same as your school's URL, it'll let you straight in. you just click on, you tell what school you're with and what your email address is, and then it sends an email to that email address with a link, and you can go straight in. So you don't have to wait. It's easy, it's fast, it's quick. If you have a Gmail address or one of your board members does, then it gets to be a longer process where you have to contact our offices. But encouragement to get your own domain name and domain email, most people do. All right? So when you do that, your comments will be indicated. It will indicate who you are. And this is part of being Christian, right? We don't want to just throw generic comments out there. And the vendors do not have access to this. No one can see these but other members, okay? Affiliates don't have access. So when I'm asked by affiliates, can I get on the MRC? No, because we want our members to be able to be fairly transparent here. We're not hiding anything. We hope you will have gone and talked to them if you had a problem. But just to be able to be honest, you know, we tried Singapore math and it cost us a lot of money in training, right? That's a valid statement that you can put out there. So those are the kind of things that we hope you'll participate with us on in making this more valuable. So we look at the next one here. The board just asked me to create a strategic plan. Where do I start? Has that ever happened to anybody? Googling strategic plans is an all-day affair. I've been there. All right, so we've got, if you look at this, this is one of the things that we're, you know, we just basically went into the library. This is the library area and looked at strategic plans. So you've got Bayshores. Thank you, Bayshore. Is anybody from Bayshore here? Yeah, there. I knew Pam was there somewhere. Bayshores. And then we've got some tools and how to do strategic plans. Rockbridges is in there. In the library, you can see what we've got. We have documents that are from the ACCS directly. We have a new series, and I think we're going to get to that in a second. But as you can see, there's a lot of stuff on strategic plan here. The reason is, and by the way, we worked on this most, we had intended to have this out to you earlier. We struggled with a vendor until about January. My wife took over and said, I'll just fix it. She spent a tremendous amount of time on this, so I have to give her credit. She's figured out all of this stuff. She's a writer more than she is a web programmer, but she got it figured out. And this little button right here looks easy. It's a search engine, but she went and found one that actually indexes almost everything. So if you look at what it finds just about everything related to strategic plans. So it's a pretty good search engine. I encourage you to use it. All right, let's look at the next one here. Oh boy, it's July and my Latin teacher just quit. Now what? It's always the Latin teacher. Why can't it be like, you know, English? All right. So we've really beefed up our job exchange. The way this works is you will still, when you post jobs from your school, and it's popular, we've already got hundreds of job postings out there. Thank you all for posting. When we get a posting, it goes right out to the main site. The difference here is, if you remember under the current and old system, forum is where you would find people seeking positions. In the future, what we're doing is we're putting those out here in the MRC. Now, we'll continue sending you email to remind you that these are coming. But the benefit here is if you go to find teachers and staff, I'm going to spin down here. I hope this is nobody anybody knows, but you can go look. There's a whole bunch more information, right? We've got pictures. Got questions about what the last three books they read are, all the things that most heads of school would ask, you know. The thinking here behind this was, it's not only that you want to see a CV, but there's quite, you know, if you know, for example, their faith, if you only hire Reformed or you only hire Charismatic or whatever, that's in here. You don't need to call them and find that out, right? So we're trying to make it so that you can quickly find the people who are right for you. There's a lot of information here, if you see. Probably more than you want, but you can always quit reading and give them a call. All right? So now, we'll look at the next one here. Who can we get to come speak at our fundraising dinner or our teacher training? So this is always an issue. It's kind of word of mouth, right? You come to the conference, you hear somebody you like, you remember, oh, who was that? You keep the little, this thing, and you look them up and you try and call them. What we're trying to do is make it a lot easier to find people. And, you know, when I was head of school, especially when, in the early years, we didn't have a lot of money. And I was always thinking, oh, man, I don't even know what to offer this person, right? I don't know how to get them here to my school to speak without insulting them, right? So we have, this is the main speaker bureau thing. And so you can find out. And these are not worked out through the ACCS, right? This isn't a bureau in that sense. It's just a group of speakers that are available. So George Grant, and it tells you roughly who you contact and what his fees, his fee arrangements are, and how whether he likes to stay with families or in a hotel, all those kinds of things. Makes it easier and faster to find people. Now, we've got five or six speakers and probably 20 consultants and trainers. That list is going to grow a lot as we're able to. We're putting people out here based on speaking recommendations coming out of the conference and in other places like that. So this is one of the areas in the MRC that should be pretty valuable for you. The next one, our board is considering curriculum changes in STEM. How can I help them think classically about this? One of the things I have noted as I've consulted with schools over the years is that oftentimes the head of school or some of the board members get it. They know what they should and shouldn't be doing, but there's somebody who is not quite, they haven't read up as much, maybe they're not as far along as some, and they're the ones pushing something. And we as heads of schools or sometimes board members are going, you know, it protracts and prolongs board meetings as people debate and discuss what we should be doing in the school. So what we're doing is this distinctive school series. Now, we've only got a couple of them out, and primarily I'm writing a lot of them, but I know that they reflect largely what you guys already believe. And what they are is they're very practical, like this one. This first one is on STEM. STEM, social studies, and classical education. And what it basically says is it gives a really brief, if you look at it, some quotes at the top, and usually there's quotes all the way down this side, from various external sources who have talked about this issue. And then it says, here's how we should think about it. For example, social studies is not a classical concept. It's a scientism concept. So we need to continue to teach literature and history. Those kinds of things. Sometimes, for many of you, it'll be pretty basic, but it also provides you with an ACCS official paper that says this is kind of what. Now, we aren't telling you you have to do it this way. This is just for your use if you want to. We've got about 10 of them done, but what happens is, what I do is I write them, and then I send them out for editing to the person I know in our system that's the most versed in that, and this one was done by Ravi Jain. He's the one who edited it for me. I've got to get those edits all back. So we got 10, they'll be coming out in a while. They're things like assessment and, you know, discipline, all the things that these are not like how to, they're here's the boundaries of the way we should think about this. I think they'll be more helpful when you look at them offline or in the future. So let's look at some teacher requests. I wonder if anyone's done a chant on Roman history. Well, this one's a no-brainer because you guys remember we had all those chants out there before. We just pretty much have the same chants. We haven't done a lot with these. They're just easier to find, so there they all are. They're just easy to find and quick. You know, you can get to them like this. Now, what I'd love to do and what I'm hoping we'll be able to do with your help is record these things being done and upload them, and so we're working on the ability to do that, and when you can do that, then that'll make it easier than just having the printed song and chant. So that's something that we'll develop along the way. So the next teacher one, I need to teach Beowulf to eighth graders. What should I look for? So when you look at that, teachers always get surprised, right? when that Latin teacher quit, we moved the eighth grade teacher to the Latin teacher position, and now, you know, Jim has to come in and teach eighth grade. He's never taught eighth grade. He doesn't know anything about it. He's maybe versed in Beowulf, but doesn't really know what to look out for as far as inappropriate passages or things like that. So that's what this Great Books Forum is for. So we have all these great books, and they give you a synopsis of the book and what are some key portions of this text, some of the great ideas that are in it, content warnings. If there's, you know, like in Confessions, there's some areas you probably don't want to go into with some age groups. And so, and then there's, you can join the discussion and rank how you use it and that kind of thing. This is just kind of a nice to have. When we get the full curriculum center built out, it'll be much more useful, but that's coming in version 2. And that's where we actually connect up a lot of the data you guys have sent us about what curriculum you're using. I don't know, a couple of years ago I asked for that, and you're probably wondering what you did with it. Well, it's still in our system. And it actually is, the database has been populated, and we're just trying to connect the dots, and so that's coming in the next version. But for now, you can still find some fun stuff. There's even an area here for grammar school teachers, classroom readings that helps you choose various books that would be good. And a lot of these are known, but some of them may be unknown. I don't know, like the Collier's Junior Classics, if you guys don't know what those are, you can buy them at the secondary market, that kind of thing. So, some helpful information in the Curriculum Center. And being almost out of time, I think I'll jump to the training section real quick. This area, of course, indexes all the training that's available through various sources. We've got the ACCS directly, the endorsed sources that we've always done, like with Logos and Rockbridge, and then a lot of other training sources that you can get to. Again, we're trying to make as much available to you as possible and not tie it to whether we have endorsement relationships with them. We do want you to use our endorsed trainers if you can, but there's lots of options here. We also have, let's see, teacher training, I think. We'll get it. Oh, no, that's the one I'm on. Go to that's under. All trainers and consultants. So this is just a listing of trainers and consultants, and it's a lot like the speakers piece. And it just has the various people that are commonly consulting in our industry. Now, what I'm not doing is putting anybody in here who's not specific to classical education. So like, you won't see ISM or any of those in here because I figure you can find those. We would have a kind of a rush on everybody wanting to be in this directory. But these are just directories that help you pick trainers, consultants, those kind of things. So that is the MRC. Any questions about the MRC? All right. Well, I hope you can find it useful. When you go out there. So this is the CCI. We're trying to name it something to try and describe it, but really it's just what we already have. It's a collection of tools. Right now the problem we're trying to solve is that anytime progressive education is the primary source of something, like standardized testing, if it's with Terra Nova or whatever, you drag the Common Core stuff in, right? Anytime you are dealing with licensed teachers in your state, you drag in the Dewey and training that they got in college. Anytime you're, you know, trying to contend with accreditation, if you're accredited through, for example, Advanced Ed, you're pulling in whatever they've got in their utilities that isn't classical. So what we're trying to do is build a robust system that is outside of the public arena completely. So we've talked about accreditation. You've seen what we've done with teacher certification. We're the curriculum provision. We've already got great curriculum providers. You see them up here in our vendor area. We're trying to set up some system for the future as we grow to make sure that those who are recognized by the ACCS are actually classical curriculum providers. We've developed a relationship with the CLT. If you guys don't take that, I would really encourage you to. It's a much better test in the in deep secondary, like 9 through 12. They've developed about, I think, the 9 through 12 area of their program right now. In fact, you can take the CLT 10, which is for 10th graders, I think, for free, because it's for a National Merit Scholar kind of thing, only it's not called that because it's with a different organization. So you can see it's kind of all worked in there. In the future, what we're going to be doing with the new MRC is this is our back-end database. Some of you saw that this last year when you renewed your membership. We're trying not to expose you to this too much because the database itself is a little clunkier, and so we're building in connections so that you'll be able to more easily enter your school's information without having to go into our database to do it. And you saw Geronimo, amen, if you were here last night. We're trying to continue to build on a video that will be useful for all of our members to be able to use as a way to communicate to your parents. The kind of the idea behind Geronimo, amen, when it's re-edited, is to kind of convey to parents, you're going to miss out if you don't get on the classical bandwagon. It's kind of an idea that, rather than trying to sell it to them, just let them know if you aren't on board with this, you're going to miss out. And that's kind of, I don't know if those of you who saw it, it's an encouraging, enthusiastic kind of an approach. It's not, you know, dire and looking for negatives. It's looking for positives. So that's what Geronimo Amen is, and that is the end of my presentation. Yes. Good question. So what we're trying to do right now is we made it with a limited number of schools, and we're going to add a few schools to it. So actually, Davey's talked about having it available in about a month. I think we miscommunicated. It'll probably be the next enrollment season that you'll be able to use it, because we've got to re-edit it, pull out some of the stuff, and insert schools in Texas and in the middle part of the country and in a few other areas. That's going to take us till about January. So I anticipate we may have something available before January, but it may be around January before we can get that up. But it should be in time for your next enrollment period, which should help you. And we'll get it out as soon as we can. Any other questions? Yes, way in the back.
Oh.
Yep, barely.
I've been at the ACCS for 10 years, and I want to tell you what has happened in the last 2 years has been phenomenal. I want to tell you, I really do appreciate it. That's the first thing I want to say.
Thank you.
And the second thing I want to ask, because I wasn't able to hear at the very beginning, were you saying that you're going to allow me to start working on getting teachers certified before the school becomes accredited?
No. No. What I had said was close to that, which is I would encourage you to use the certification training program for teachers before you get accredited. But you can't actually certify a teacher until you're accredited. And the obvious reason for this, anybody who understands how our certification system got built, in the modern world, right, you can stamp out a teacher by simply running them through a teacher's college and getting them licensed. We believe teaching is a gift from the Lord, and that the best people to apprentice and to develop teachers are the schools. And so we want the schools doing the certification. But then you run into the problem, well, how do you know if they're doing it the way so that we have consistency? Because these teachers can move between schools a lot easier. And that's why we have the accreditation requirement. So I'd like to say what you said, but unfortunately it is, you can use the training program, and we'd encourage you to do that. Other questions? I think I'm up against time, if I'm not mistaken. So with that, I will thank you very much for coming. We have a booth up there. I'm not there very often, but if you want to pick up materials that are laying out on it, I'd encourage you to get some materials. Thank you.